on the download, actor Gary Oldman, retired sports talk show host Terry Bores, and wildlife photographer David Yarrow. Now here's your host, a man who is also a wildlife photographer, if by wildlife photographer you mean taking cat selfies, Justin Coffin.
Hey, I get mittens in his habitat underneath the tree, the Christmas tree. Once in a while, he comes out from under the bed. I mean, that's Pulitzer Prize winning, right? I would be a terrible wildlife photographer. I'd be the kind of guy, like, the minute a lion showed up anywhere near me, I'd be like, I gotta go. You know, we'll get it from it. Let's get an aerial shot. Let's get in a helicopter. David Yarrow's stuff is amazing. First of all, welcome to the download. Justin Coffman here with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We have an outstanding show. Outstanding. Now, these kind of shows come around, I mean, they come around 2, 3, 4 times a week. No, this is awesome. First off, Gary Oldman, one of the best actors working today, surprisingly without an Oscar, if you listen to Rich Roper talk a little bit during Row about The Darkest Hour, the film that's he's playing Winston Churchill. Gary Oldman doesn't have an Oscar, and that is going to change. I guarantee right now that you will be watching the Oscars in March, and they'll be like, and the winner is Gary Oldman. I don't know who I'm being, whoever. It's my Dame Judi Dench, maybe. Gary Oldman, The Darkest Hour. He's tremendous in this film. I really enjoy his performance. And like I told Ro in the crosstalk and Anna, we got a chance to catch up with him when he was in town a couple weeks ago now, where we got to do the old fancy sort of Janet Davies fancy hotel interview where Gary Oldman's like in a suite, one of the fancy hotels on Michigan Avenue. I get to come in after, you know, like the journalist's like revolving door of people who get there 5 minutes with Gary Oldman. I got 10. So we're going to air that tonight. But it's set up for TV. That's the only thing I don't like about those things. The radio people get completely disrespected. We never get any love. Like, it's set up to the fact that they just videotape it and then give us the videotape and then tell us to extract the audio off of it, which is not necessarily how you want to do it just because it makes me sound off mic. But Gary Oldman, we didn't want to pass up on the chance to talk to him because I've always loved his work, and the film is amazing, so we get a chance to talk to Gary Oldman. We'll air that coming up after the 7:30 news tonight. Gary Oldman! And that's just the beginning! Terry Bores is on the program tonight. Famed Bores and Bernstein co-host over at The Score and sports talk radio for 25 years. Retired this last year. He's written a new book called The Score of a Lifetime. 25 years talking Chicago sports. Terry Bores in studio at the big table to talk about his life behind a microphone, but just also being a part of a movement. When The Score started in 1992, there was no sports talk in Chicago. I mean, there were shows here on WGN and other stations that would do sports, but there was not a format dedicated to it. And Terry Bores is one of the founders of that format. And we'll talk to him about his illustrious career, the ups and downs and challenges. Also, the health concerns he's had later in life. Terry Bores, our guest tonight. Also, as you just mentioned, David Yarrow, one of the greatest wildlife photographers on the planet. The stuff he does is truly amazing. You've heard of his work. You've seen his work. He is at the forefront, if not the biggest, wildlife photographer working today. He has got an exhibit in River North. It's amazing to think that he has not been on display in Chicago, pretty much anywhere. He's had a couple of little shows here and there, but he is turning his... It used to be that he would shoot for National Geographic or other places, and now he's turning his attention more to doing gallery work. So he's at the Hilton Osmus Contemporary Gallery in the River North here through, I think it's to January. David Yarrow. Talked to him about how he actually captures the just amazing, beautiful, thrilling photos of lions, tigers, bears, elephants, everything in between. It's stuff that you know, he's got one of the coolest jobs for anyone who's ever lived. And then also tonight we'll talk about how to Christmas so hard, right? Pete Zimmerman, our resident Christmas expert. I'm very excited to have this segment, which we're going to do once a week, about how to Christmas so hard in Chicago. It's important. I'm a perfect example. Every weekend, I'm like, what am I going to do to maximize my time to be the best holiday reveler, student of the holidays? And Pete Zimmerman's got your back.
You're already one step ahead by seeing the Nutcracker.
Yeah, right? I'm done. That's my problem is I'm done now.
Oh.
I just rest. I rest on the fact that I saw the Nutcracker. But it's funny because thinking about this segment, I've been looking at, tee boxes this weekend. I don't know if that's going to be in your report of things to do. But I've been thinking about every time I come across something, I'm like, oh, wonder what Pete thinks of this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so I'm already ahead of you.
A tee box, no, sadly did not make a list.
Didn't make the list. But oh. There you go. All right, we'll do that.
Not too many
up.
People have, suits, green suits. That
not everybody can dress up like Will Ferrell and Elf, right?
Right.
And then drink Coors Light for morning, noon, and night. That's T-Box. All right, news, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. We'll take a break. Stay with us. This is The Download, 720 WGN. Let's carry out. All right, here are today's top stories. I'm good enough, strong enough, doggone it. I'm resigning from the Senate. Al Franken, the former SNL writer slash performer slash satirical book author and now slash Minnesota senator, resigned his post after allegations of sexual misconduct surfaced over the past month. This also after Democrats spoke out and asked for his resignation in droves. But don't pat yourself on the back just yet, Dems. It was politically convenient to take a stand because a Democratic governor in Minnesota appoints his replacement. In the case of Roy Moore in Alabama, if Republicans tell him to get out of the race, then they automatically lose that seat to Democrats. Something tells me if that were the case with Franken, Dems would be much more about atonement in their tweets rather than banishment. But regardless, Republicans everywhere are loving watching Franken's demise because he's been such a beloved liberal even before he went to the Senate. In a much weirder moment, Arizona Congressman Trent Franks resigned for alleged sexual misconduct, in which in this case amounted to asking some of his female staffers if they would have his baby. He's apparently looking for a surrogate, so he asked women who he worked for in Congress if they'd be up for it. Hey, can you file this paperwork? Can you carry my baby? I'm sorry. Can I trouble you for a coffee run? Which one doesn't fit there? Wow. In other news, Senate cleared the spending bill and averted a government shutdown. Yay! Let's see what they did here. They came up with a comprehensive plan to table the plan for 2 weeks. Oh, got it. Another legislative accomplishment, though. Write it down. That's a win. It's a two-week win. Closer to home, former police superintendent Gary McCarthy is said to be interested in running for mayor. He's hiring fundraisers now. McCarthy was famously fired by Mayor Emanuel after the Laquan McDonald tape was released. Yeah, that won't come up in the campaign, right? So really looking forward to those two measuring each other up, huh, through campaign ads about who messed up more on the Laquan McDonald stuff. McCarthy can run all he wants, but he's got a long way to go with the African-American community here in town, whose leaders came forward and wanted him ousted even before the McDonald's shooting. So something to watch. CPS Chief Forrest Claypool's in hot water after an inspector general told the Chicago Public School Board that Claypool should be terminated for his cover-up and lying over an ethics issue involving a friend and a law firm. I guess the law firm fired his friend, and then he hired his friend, and he put his friend in charge of the law firm that works with the schools. I feel like I messed that up, right? But I think I got it, right? I got it? It makes sense? Or no? It doesn't make sense to me, but I think I got it. But point being, the IG says that CPS had six different lawyers say it was a bad idea, and Claypool found a seventh, another friend, to say, yeah, I guess it's okay, and then tried to cover up that the other six had differing opinions. It's not as saucy as, say, oh, will you carry my baby? But it is a scandal, and it's a guy who runs the schools, and what message are we sending to our kids? He's saying, tell the truth, but if it doesn't work for you, the truth, keep trying to find someone else to back you up while covering it up while lying to the inspector general twice. It's just not a good motto to put on the front of the school door, right? Stay in school is much better and shorter. Hezbollah is calling for an anti-U.S. protest in Palestine and other Middle Eastern countries. It has been a while since we've seen the mass protest burning the American flag footage. splattered all over the cable news channels. So have at it. B-roll cameramen are just like freaking out. They're like, finally, yes! Let's get some new, B-roll, right? So get ready for that for the next 6 months. A tourist couple decided to take Lower Wacker along Columbus to get to their hotel, and they were robbed at knife point. Is that how you say it? Knife point? Is it the right? They lost thousands of dollars in computers, luggage, and an engagement ring. How about the cops will find that stuff? But man, I avoid walking on Lower Wacker during the day. Can you imagine walking through there at 2 a.m. in a serious cold? Has anyone else seen Batman? Don't go down there. And it was all because GPS told him it was the best route. Between this and always wanting to take me on the expressway, GPS is becoming persona non grata, right? When reached for comment, GPS was like, take 290. No, I'm asking rerouting. No, I want to ask it, make U-turn. Rideshare companies have announced their top destinations of 2017. Uber says Wrigley Field was a top spot for rides. Second place, the restaurant just out of walking distance. That one that you apologize to the driver for? I'm sorry, I'm just going four blocks. The Mars rover captured an image of a strange sphere that has conspiracy theorists calling it a cannonball left over from the Great Martian War. Yep. They say it's a sign of extraterrestrial life, where NASA says it's just a round rock. So you can see how there's a lot of gray area in between. Sure. Scientists are excited over new robot news. I guess they're having breakthroughs in teaching robots to see their future. This would help with understanding consequences and possibly understanding cause and effect. They tried it on one robot who looked at his future and then got super depressed. I end up in middle management. I'm going to order a pizza. In weather, it's too cold. In sports, the Bulls, Blackhawks, and the Bears are a combined 0-20. The last 20. 20. What is this, the mid-70s? The season ended today. The Bears would get the 6th pick in next year's draft. So there's still some work to do in these last four games to make that a top 5 or maybe even a top 3 pick. So we got to get back to the practice room and really focus on losing out, guys. Let's do that. Lose it out. This weekend is the winter meetings in Orlando. Cubs got to jump on the deals by signing Rockies starting pitcher Tyler Chatwood for more than a little $12 million a year. It's not bad at all. Less than that. Which by starting pitching is a steal. Chapman had an okay year last year, but he has 2 Tommy John surgeries in his young career. But Tyler Chatwood is a cool name. He gets a little success here. I could see a nice little barbecue place in Schaumburg. Chatwood's, right? I'd go. There you go. And finally tonight, this weekend, the T-Box Pub Crawl takes over Wrigleyville. Here's what you do. You dress up like Elf or Cousin Randy from Christmas Vacation, and you act like you do after seeing a Cubs game. Stand in line, drink dumb liquor, and pee on condos. And now it's a tradition. That's my favorite part. Yeah. I won't be there. Well, that's the carryout for December 7, 2017. Hey, we have a new candy cane flavor for our chicken wings. It's cayenne peppermint. It's not good, but it's festive. All right, coming up, Gary Oldman, actor, star of Darkest Hour, where he gets to play Winston Churchill. We'll talk about his career and playing this role. Also, Terry Bores, the longtime sports talk show host over at The Score, and his new book, The Score of a Lifetime. It's a download tonight. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Oh, man, I'm doing well. How are you doing?
I'm good. I'm
excited about this Gary Oldman interview.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah.
I'm excited to hear how it went, if you can really feel the chemistry between me and Gary.
You just dove right in, didn't you? You know, Gary, I'm not going to waste any time here. I'm just going to go right into the deep end with you.
Let me get right in there. Yeah. How do you feel? Sorry, Ryan.
What's your motivation?
Tell me about the emotion you're feeling right now.
How many martinis did you consume in the run-up to your portrayal of Winston Churchill?
Yeah, he's a lot of drinking in that movie.
Yeah.
There you go. It's a great movie. Check it out.
Do you know Winston Churchill's idea of a dry martini?
What?
To look at the bottle of vermouth as he passes the bar? A little anecdote for you.
There you go.
I'm full of them.
There you go. All right. I love it. Thanks, Rob. It's a download here, 720 WGN. Coming up at 8 o'clock tonight, Terry Bores. His new book, The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. Terry Bores, of course, one of the founding personalities behind The Score, a radio station here in Chicago, as well as the program Bores and Bernstein, which was a staple in afternoons for 17 years till Terry retired last year. We'll talk with him about his career. Coming up at 8 o'clock, the big table. So stay with us. All right. Tonight, Gary Oldman. That's what we're going to do here. Guy had a chance to catch up with the famed actor when he was in town promoting his new film, Darkest Hour, where he portrays Winston Churchill in the lead up to World War II. It's a tremendous film. We'll get into it in this conversation. But I had a chance to talk with him. It was a couple weeks ago. He was set up in one of these swanky hotels right here on Michigan Avenue. And it's really set up for the TV, you know, for people to come in. So you see Gary Oldman in the high chair with the poster behind him. You know what I'm talking about? And they kind of throw to it. So it's set up for TV. So it's maybe not the best quality when it comes to audio for radio. But it's still Gary Oldman, and we didn't want to pass up on the opportunity to talk with him. So let's take a listen.
The new film, Darkest Hour, coming out soon. And to say a tremendous film. Gary Oldman plays Winston Churchill right at the beginning of World War II. Gary Oldman, a tremendous performance. I have to ask, what drew you to playing such a larger-than-life character as Winston Churchill?
Well, it was really... it was more what other people saw. When it was first mentioned, long before I read a script, I poo-pooed the idea and found it quite laughable, because you're dealing with someone who is arguably the greatest Briton that ever lived, some would say. Someone who understood self-promotion and marketing. Homburg cigar, the silhouette is infamous. It's just, you know, it's just so, not infamous, famous, and iconic, that if someone had said to me, they're thinking, they're making a movie, they're making a movie about Stan Laurel, I could go, yeah, maybe I could do that, you know. So it was quite, you know, it was never really, I dismissed it. And then it kept coming back, it kept washing up. And it was an idea that Eric had had, that Eric Fellner, the producer, who then shared that with Joe Wright, and they were like dogs with a bone. And I thought, well, what are they seeing? You know, could I do this? And I started to then read some of the material and look at some of the Pathé, you know, the Pathé footage of him and the wartime.
What did you know? I mean, you, of course, growing up, you know Winston Churchill, you know Spudfitch. Did you know of this time, this period, his politics, everything that goes into this specific time?
I knew some of it, but I did not realize quite how close we came to a negotiation of making some deal with him. Churchill, to me, growing up as a boy, was good old, you know, Winnie. You know, he was our saviour. He was the man that stood up to Hitler, and he was the man that won the war. So he was a national hero, a treasure, you know.
As an actor, he's had such a diverse career. He played so many different types. In this case, it's one thing to play a historical figure, to do a biography. It's to learn his mannerisms, to his accent and his words. But it's another to transform yourself and to, with makeup and costume, to be a different body type, to the manners, the movements, the mumble, everything. As an actor, is that make it more challenging, the idea that you're not just having to find the spirit of Winston Churchill, but you have to find Winston Churchill on the outside as well?
Well, it was the biggest roadblock. I mean, it was the elephant in the room. You know, you can look at footage, you can read the books, you can study, you can listen to the recordings. You can do all of that and quite, I think, happily play Winston Churchill in your dressing gown, you know, in your kitchen, you know, walking around with an unlit cigar, you know, doing all the moves. But yeah, it was, I think my saying yes to it finally was contingent on being able to get Kazuhiro, who designed the makeup. I thought if there's anyone on the planet that could do it, it would be this man, you know, because I'd seen his previous work and thought he was such a master. I mean, he's such an artist that... But he had retired and got out of the movie business, and so it was a case of going to him, who, I mean, talk about things, the stars lining up. He lives in L.A., I live in L.A., and his studio's 20 minutes away. I mean, you couldn't have wished for... I mean, he could have been living in, you know, Belgium or somewhere where, you know... So he was actually literally around the corner. And I went and we met and he scratched his head and said, I don't know even know if it's doable. And I said, well, you're the guy, so if you can't do it and you're telling me it can't be done, then I believe it. But he did a sculpt, and I just seduced him, got him out of retirement, and there's no CG, it's all...
Is there a different focus for an actor when you're in such a transformative role where you're not that body type, where you're... Is it tougher for you to remain as Winston Churchill throughout?
Because even it's freeing. It's completely the other...
Really?
Yeah. For me, it got to a point where it was like breathing. Yeah. It's like wearing a T-shirt. You're not aware of... when you're first putting it on and then you realise that you've got to sit absolutely still for 3.5 hours and you've got to do it 48 days consecutively, you know, it's... You go, oh, my God, yeah, OK, you know, and then it's half an hour to put the suit on. But... You know, it's like lifting weights, and then your muscles ache, and then the more you do it, you know, you're less fatigued.
Right.
So it's only exercising a muscle. Do you know what I mean? You kind of so you surrender completely to it. Otherwise, you would go insane. You know, and I know some actors have, you know, got to a point where they tear the makeup off and they go, So you've got to really know what you're getting into. But it was. It was freeing, yeah.
My last question for you is really about focus, because the character of Winston Churchill in this film is one that at certain points in order and a tremendous performance in Parliament and makes decisions, but then the other sense there's mumblings and almost a ADD, if you will, like that you can't really follow him.
Yeah.
As an actor, there's something about the concept of being focused to act unfocused. And I found that to almost be a great contrast in this man, but also in your performance.
Yeah. I mean, a great deal of it is to do with... One of the secrets of acting is being able to forget everything else. You know, that old saying where people... I would do plays and people would say, oh, my God, how do you remember all those lines? And... Really, you go by forgetting everything else. So for 2 hours or 3 hours of a play, you are so focused. So it is about concentration, but it needs equal amounts of that than to play someone who is so... has such a command of language to then go the other direction.
Right.
I mean, all I was basically thinking about was that he knew from the very beginning, way back in the early 30s, that Hitler was a bad dude. I mean, he got his number very quickly, even, and made himself unpopular saying so, where everyone around him was saying there will never be another war. There is no need to rearm. You know, Germany, it's all going to be fine. And he stuck to his belief. He never wavered from that.
Right.
He knew that Hitler was a bad guy. And so what I played was that he was being pressurized and cornered to go against his gut feeling,
right,
his intuition, and that it stuck in his throat. He so couldn't articulate it that he would almost retch on the words. And that is how I... That was kind of the...
I approached it.
Yeah.
Gary Oldman, tremendous performance as Winston Churchill in the new film Darkest Hour. Can't thank you enough for taking some time out.
There you go. Gary Oldman, in a new segment I'm calling Off Mic'd. Had a chance to catch up with the famed actor who is the star of the new film Darkest Hour, who plays Winston Churchill. He's going to win an Oscar for it at one of the hotels here up on Michigan Avenue when he was in town promoting the film about 2 weeks ago. And as you said, I mean, it's great. That I'm very, very happy that they gave us the time to do that. It's mostly set up for TV, and I weaseled my way in, which is always good. But at the same time, you know, I would like to be on a microphone as well. But I don't need to because Gary Oldman, he can have both mics. I know people were excited that I had Gary Oldman on just based on all the GIFs that were put on my Facebook page. Like he's a monster GIF guy. You know what I mean? Like all the roles that he's done, whether it be in The Professional or vampire movie or whatever else he's been in, millions of movies, that there's a clip that gets pulled out in 5 seconds worth that gets easily embedded on people's Facebook page. It's pretty awesome.
Now that's something on Facebook I'm interested in.
Yeah, right. I will say it's funny because I know this is stupid. I know that I'm ignorant in the way that Gary Oldman ignorant, but I didn't recognize two things. At the end of that interview, when I was walking out, he goes, "Oh, it's great to be back in Chicago," or he just said, "It's great. I love this city," and I didn't say anything because I was walking out. I'm like, "Well, good to see you. Who can I take any of this fruit? Is any of this fruit okay?" And from his sweet and. But then I recognized that because I kind of said, "Yeah, well, it's always great. It's good to have you here," or something that made it seem like he didn't spend any time here. And then I was walking out, I'm like, duh, Commissioner Gordon, Batman. He spent probably 10 years of his life doing those 3 or 4 movies, right? Or at least the 2, 3. I mean, the first one, they're all set in Chicago. So, you know, he probably knows a lot about this town. I'm sitting here going, "Welcome to our fine city, sir. This is what you call Michigan Avenue. Have you at all been under... There's an upper Wacker and a lower Wacker. Have you had a chance to see the river and all the buildings along the river? Maybe in a grand sweeping way? You've been out to Navy Pier. Or perhaps 2 tourism boats were hijacked by the Joker." Yeah, I didn't realize that. I should have spent the second half just talking about Batman. But instead, we talked about the Winston Churchill film, Darkest Hour. Go see it. I love it. I'm not a huge fan of World War II history. And today, of course, the Pearl Harbor Day. But getting a chance to see that film and for them to do such a good job portraying what was happening in Britain and right as, you know, Hitler's forces marched and overran France. It's a really, really good movie. And so, yeah, Gary Oldman. Coming up, Terry Bores. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest is a familiar voice to Chicagoans, not only from his time at The Score, but also as a columnist at the Sun-Times. Terry Bores has a new memoir out called The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. Bores was one of the original voices featured on The Sports Talker, and in the book, he writes about getting The Score off the ground. Bores had plenty of on-air partners over the years, but cemented himself as talk radio royalty with his role on the Bores and Bernstein Show, which paired him up with Dan Bernstein, aired weekdays afternoons for 17 years. Bors retired from the score about a year ago. In the book, Bors talks about his health problems, ultimately being diagnosed with cancer and dealing with the effects of chemotherapy and radiation. Terry Bors currently splits time between here and Florida. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, I'm going to head to Florida in the winter. I have some softball commitments I made. I've tried to get this old body into shape, so I'm going to play softball. And the only bad news so far with the softball is one of the guys that occasionally shows up and plays is Dante Bichette. I think that's a little bit out of my league.
Terry Bors, welcome to the download. Great to have you. Longtime listener.
Well, thanks for having me. Appreciate
first-time
it.
Interviewer. So,
yes, you are.
Yeah, but where does the idea of a book come from for you? Because I listen to you, and I've always thought and taken from your personality that you don't like to look inward, that you're more of a guy
I
who's
don't.
Like,
no,
yeah,
absolutely
where does,
true.
Where's the idea of coming up with a memoir?
You know, I said it one day on the air a long time ago that I promised it, because people wanted to know this, they wanted to know that, they wanted to know what happened here, what happened there, and I said, it'll be in the book. It's one of those things you just throw out so they leave you alone a second. You know what? If you got time now, I could tell you, but otherwise it'll be in the book. So after a while, when you sort of make that commitment, when you promise people and the number of people that you see, whether it's a remote or just in the street, wherever, I committed myself to it a long time ago. So I started putting notes together in my mind while some of it was fresh, because the older you get, the further away the memories get. So I had a lot of newspaper stuff left over, because I talked a lot about covering sports in the 80s, which I did, and had a lot of that stuff left over. Those notes were good. The tapes were still good. Notes were still good. The score, I needed a little help on here and there, you know, because when you're in the middle of it, you sort of miss some of the politics of it.
Right.
Some of the things that
which
happened.
Which is actually a good thing, right? As a talent, you don't want to be in all the politics.
We had enough problem that convincing somebody to actually listen to the thing. So, I mean, that was the first problem we had. Is anybody listening? Anybody out there? We had no computers, so they would put a... Like where we're sitting now, DM Radio, they would put whose caller on there. If there'd be a caller, maybe two a day. And they would have to put his name up there and print it and put it up on the wall, tack it up
on
the wall.
And this is what, 1992? This is the beginning of the score?
92, yeah.
You know, I think about that, and then I think, wow, it's great that talk show host Terry Bors is going to write a book. But then I remember you had a long career in print. You were a writer and a columnist for the Sun-Times, other places. Talk about that. Talk about how that prepared you, or just the idea of getting back to the written word.
Well, I got back to the written word. I started in 72 at a smaller paper and then went to a little bigger paper in 74 and loved it there. Loved the guy I worked for. Loved it enormously. But when you start having children, I don't know whose they were. They might have been mine. And you start having children and you go, all of a sudden, I'm not making enough money to we have to do something. Because I would have never left it. I would have been a lazy guy and just sit there. I was playing softball and doing everything I wanted to do and still married. But then all of a sudden it hits you that, So I talked to the Sun-Times. They said, well, we won't hire you to get to a bigger paper. I said, well, what? You're either I am or I'm not. Am I or am I not? And they said, nope. We'll talk to you if you get to a bigger paper. So I took a job at the Detroit Free Press, and I worked a desk and made me promise not to ask them to write. I didn't. Pretty soon I'm out writing. I buy a house, and 3 days after we buy a house up there, we'd been renting a house. 3 days after I buy a house, the Sun-Times calls and offers me a job on the desk. And I get to the Sun-Times, and they say, you don't want a Marty Kaiser. I said, you're not going to write here either. I said,
Okay.
All right. I won't. I didn't. I said I didn't. I knew what I signed up for. And the Bulls job, which, you know, I had never really done anything. I'd covered a little Tigers baseball, some Michigan State football and so forth, just odds and ends and when I was at the Free Press. And I thought, well, you know, I'd never really done a beat. So I didn't know if I could do it or not, because it's all in deadline. It's all you got 15 minutes to do this. It's all the travel. It's all of the other stuff that goes with it. And you have to convince yourself you can do it. I mean, I know guys today believe they can do anything, but I had some doubt that you can do that. There's a difference between saying, well, yeah, I could sit down and write something, right, or I can sit down and write something in 15 minutes.
Right.
Thank God people weren't paying attention to the Bulls.
And a sport that you were familiar with, but wasn't necessarily familiar with this team,
right,
and with NBA basketball. There's a lot that goes into being a beat writer, especially in a different time.
It was a challenge. You know, I never had to write that fast. I worked at a paper. In Detroit, I almost blew the first deadline. I had 3 hours to write it, like 10 paragraphs, and couldn't do it. It was in my mind forever that, are you going to freeze every time there's no pressure? You know, sometimes generally after the Bulls game got done, I had like a half an hour. You have to file an early story, and then I had a half hour to file the final of the game. Not that anybody was paying attention, because it was the perfect beat, because I love basketball, and it was the perfect place to go up until 84.
Right.
Then all of a sudden somebody came to town, and things started to change a little bit. It took a little while. It took 5-6 years before they really got it together and got the players around Jordan. But when he got there, I just remember distinctly being the only ones really excited about it. I mean, I thought, don't you know, it's like the Bears were the hottest thing going, right? The Bears, the Bears are the story. The Bears are this. The Cubs had won in 84.
Right,
yeah,
right.
And the White Sox had won in 83. So it's like
no one was paying attention to the Bulls.
No one was paying attention to the Bulls. And I thought, that's okay.
What I love about the book, too, is that you get into some of the specifics and some of the stuff I don't think I've ever heard about Michael Jordan when you think about the players around him at that time as a rookie, Larry Bird, other people. We know the Larry Bird quote, but some of his teammates coming out of practice saying, this is the greatest player that's
yes,
ever played.
This is the greatest I've ever played against. Lockery said that to me after the first practice. He said, Terry, I just saw the greatest player who ever lived. I said, where was he, Kevin? He said, he's on the floor. I said, well who was that? And it's like, don't tell him. Don't use
don't
that.
Tell him.
Don't use that. And I said, I promise you, I won't use that. But, yeah, you had guys. It's one thing about basketball, and they say the ball don't lie, right? One thing you know is when you know it when you see it. Baseball players are going to have bad days, and football players are going to have bad days, and basketball players are going to have some. But when you see that a certain talent level for the guy, you just know it.
Right.
I can see it, a young kid. I can see it. I mean, it is so – I mean, maybe just from being around those guys and knowing what it takes to be one of those guys. Because being an NBA player is – that's a dream of a lifetime for a lot of people, and it's a terrific way to make a wonderful living. That's great to do it. But when you think about – people who think, well, my kid's going to play in the NBA, I'm going, no. He may be a great player now, but there's such a difference when you watch them. And you go, I played that game, not that game, though. I didn't play that game. And even guys who were great players in college would come into camp. Because when I started, there were 7 rounds of the draft.
Wow. Think about that now.
7
second
rounds.
Rounders don't even make the roster. That's now.
Seven,
right.
So you had 7 guys coming in every training camp. It was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? I haven't even heard of this guy, and he was gone within like a week and a half anyway. But it's one of those sports where you just know it if you see it. I mean, it's hard to describe. I think you could probably say this some of other maybe guys more of a scout's eye than I have. Mm-hmm. But basketball, after being around it with them and then covering a lot of basketball after I was off the Bulls, even doing NCAAs and all that stuff that in the Olympics, you just know it.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt you can watch a practice and you can watch, you know, 12 pro athletes going at it. I could sit down and write to – if you put no numbers on them, I could write
tell.
You the starting lineup without even knowing who they are. I could tell you who they are. And I don't say I would be right, but you can tell.
Let's do this. Let's take a quick break, and I want to come back and talk about – because the next transition you made in your career was to columnist, which is a more natural transition to being a sports talker,
mm-hmm.
especially
yep.
at a new radio station in Chicago in 1992. Terry Bohr is my guest. His book, The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. We'll talk with the iconic, the talk show royalty.
Oh, yeah, talk
in the
show
building
royalty.
Right now, Terry Bohr is at the big table. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download Here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, Terry Bohrs, the longtime host at the Bohrs and Bernstein Show that wrapped up after 17 years last year at The Score. He's got a new book, The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. Sit down and talk about your illustrious career in broadcast and in journalism, because we talk about in the first segment just talking about you being a beat writer, but you made a transition to columnist, which is much closer to the idea of being a talk radio show.
Yeah, and there's no doubt. And I made it in 88. They offered the column to me, and I thought, well, I'll take that. Because we had a lot of guys were leaving, and I think John Shulian was the one who was left, who was a terrific writer. But I think I did all right with it. I mean, I critically acclaimed by some, and others thought I was an idiot. But that's okay. I was there to be both.
As a columnist is supposed to be.
Yeah, I was there to be both.
Right.
I mean, I wasn't a taste for everybody. But I always felt like you stay to who you are. And it's a whole different thing when you're covering the team than when you're the columnist. Because then you're completely the outsider. It's like, and what do you want? Who are you? What are you doing here? Except Michael. Michael and I always got along. And that was the years when the Bulls were getting good. But our relationship was always great. But I would fight with Jerry Krause, and I came to appreciate Jerry Krause and what he said and what he did as the years went on. I think there's a certain thing to being a columnist, and I went to the 88 Olympics, which was a great time, a lot of fun there.
You know, as a columnist who had a background in being a beat reporter, so you had the relationship with athletes, but
yep.
as you mentioned, as a columnist, you're an outsider.
Oh, yeah,
and
absolutely.
Sometimes you have to tell the story in a way that's not favorable to the team or to the athlete,
oh, yeah.
right?
Yeah.
More than a beat reporter has to. Was it difficult to make that transition when athletes and because you talk in the book about, you know, your relationships with people like Mike Ditka or Ron Santo or others where
not good, yeah.
Not good because they remember words that you wrote about them at certain or talked about on the air.
It's funny, I never met Ron Santo in my life until Mike Murphy's wedding. And I never met him in my life. And he walked up to his wedding and said something untoward. And I guess he was listening to the score. Our paths didn't cross as me writing about him. So I don't know what his... The Ditka thing I understand. I completely get the Ditka thing. Because, look, I mean, I know he's America's hero. But if you pay attention, really not. And you look at it and you say, well, first of all, you can't tell guys not to do this and not to do that when you're doing everything. How can you? How can you possibly?
Otis Wilson on his book talking about that.
How can you possibly tell people? Well, you can't take that ad. Don't do that. It takes too much of your time and all this. While you're riding around in Soldier Field in an armor outfit, you know, dressed like a knight. It's hard for me to justify in my mind. So I would write that, and also about the temper and the tantrums. Because remember, at a point there, he stopped speaking to Chicago media.
Right.
He's done with us. Which was fine with me. I didn't care. I was at the score by then. So when he took the job at the score, he had his own show at the score, for those who don't remember, way back when, and really made the station. I'll never take that away from him because there were people all across the country all of a sudden recognizing this, calling and saying, hey, wait a minute. You got Mike Ditka quotes?
And it was fresh. It was fresh before he was just fired by the Bears. I can understand that.
You got Mike Ditka. Yeah, we have Mike Ditka quotes. And I had to do the show with him many times. It was like, you know, we would not speak. We generally were out. We went out to a bar somewhere, and you know, so the people could touch him. Not that he really wanted to be, kind of sort of circled around and didn't really mix with people very well. But we would not speak. We never exchanged a word off the air. Hmm. Never. We probably did it a dozen times, and never once did we exchange a word off the air because I would look around and he would be up and gone. So thank you for holding a grudge. That's fine. And in my you know what it was? Imaginary columns, I used to call them.
But that's part of the job of being someone who talks and writes about sports. You have to be able to take the – because the athletes get so mad about it, and you'll see them, so Jay Cutler and others who get mad about – Brandon Marshall famously had beefs with the media, even the players now that are on the floor. A lot of times they're talking about you. They're not necessarily talking about the beat writer. They're talking about when they say, oh, the sports in this town. They're talking about Terry Borg.
Yeah, oh, I know. I know. I could deal with it. I mean, I wasn't necessarily welcome at them, but they couldn't refuse me. So I didn't have any real problem with the Bulls or the White Sox or Cubs, per se. Not really. But there's certain guys that I've gotten criticized over the years. Nobody likes it. Nobody likes it. Yeah. And sometimes I get it, sometimes I don't. And I just sort of put it aside and say, okay, that's certainly entitled to your opinion. And today everybody has an opinion. You can share it with everybody in the world if you want it. So I look at it and I say, well, okay. I mean, he clearly didn't like me, or this guy didn't like me. There's other guys who didn't like me. That's okay. The hockey people love me because nobody was bothering with hockey then. They love me. They love to see me coming out there and do a hockey column. Like, I knew what I was talking about, but I would go out there occasionally and do a hockey column. There's just certain guys, no matter what you do, whatever walk of life you're in, you're just not going to gel with. Doesn't make any difference if you're writing about it, talking to them, if you deal with them every day, whatever it is. I'm sure that people can relate to a guy you just don't get along with. You just don't like him. I mean, he doesn't like you. You don't like him. You may know why. You may not know why. It doesn't matter. All you know is that you don't mix well together. But Ditka definitely made the station.
Such an interesting, and I want to get, we'll take a quick break here in a second just for the news, but the idea of chemistry and what makes good talk radio or sports talk radio, but also knowing that, you are a voice and a personality, and there are some people that are going to take in, some that aren't, and really is part of it. And now it must be a lot different with social media, but even in your time, and people calling up saying, you're a lousy bum, Terry Forrest.
Oh, Lord. you kidding me? I spent days arguing with people that hated me. So it's sort of one of those things that newspapers where you didn't catch a lot of criticism back because it wasn't social media, so you didn't know. But when you do radio, all of a sudden they're right on top of you. They're on that phone, and they're on you. So I looked at it, and I thought, well, that's an interesting spin in your life now that they can get you.
Did you have to adjust to that?
Yeah,
early
absolutely.
On, did
that
absolutely. Play a role in emotionally how you handled your work?
Yeah, I did. I had to make adjustments throughout because I just, even though people find it strange, I wasn't used to screaming at people, but only those who were screaming at me, which is quite frequently, like Ron Santo. I never met Ron Santo in my life, and all of a sudden I'm a something, according to him. You know what you're talking about, but you're okay, all right. And that leads to what? But the callers too, and it probably, the toughest time was the O.J. Simpson trial. early on in the station too in 95. It was so difficult because
callers
it was
calling in.
Oh,
yeah.
Lord have mercy. And I mean, I'm not arguing black or white. I'm arguing right or wrong. It's got nothing to do with anything other than right or wrong. You either believe it or you don't. You believe the evidence or you don't believe. If you choose not to, I can't help
it's
you.
It's very opinionated. Country was yeah. divided.
Oh,
then,
my
right?
God. And sadly, I think we still are. Very sadly, I think we still are. I thought things were getting better and that we were understanding each other better. And clearly, that's not the case. Wrong again. Wrong again.
Wrong again. That could have been the name of your book.
Yeah,
right?
It should have been. Wrong again.
Terry Bohr is in studio. His book, The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. Of course, Terry Bohr's longtime fixture at The Score, 25 years, just retired a year ago. I was doing afternoons with Bernstein, Bohrs and Bernstein for 17 years. We'll talk about that and much more coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. In studio with me tonight, Terry Bohrs, the famous, famed talk radio
this world
royalty.
Famous is the celebrity thing
celebrity.
Is really odd.
But you are. I mean, you are in the way that, you know, Bohrs and Bernstein played for 17 years here. If you're into sports in the city of Chicago, you know that show, the new book, The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. Take us back to 1992. The Score, you know, they say, hey, there's rumblings that there's going to be an all sports format. That wasn't done here in Chicago.
No, we were the Fan in New York opened in 87. I want to say the Whip in Philadelphia opened in 89. So it's only twice done in the country. It was an experiment. But I mean, you had to figure, even though part of me would just not allow that we could ever succeed because we had the daytime license only.
That's
we
right,
were doing
yeah.
afternoon driving off the air at 4:30. And my first partner, really, I mean, really chafed at it because he's, you know, he produced it for Chet Copic and knew radio and knew what was going on. And it really bugged him. And I said, everything bugs me about what we do. Never mind the fact that we're going off at 4:30. Everything about it is just strange to me. So I learned a lot from him, observing him. And we had hosted together when Copic was gone. Oh, pray for those days. So we had gotten sort of a certain rhythm together.
What did you know about sports radio? The Fan was on, so people knew that. But for you in Chicago?
Nothing. I knew nothing.
What did you think of it? What was the thought in your head about, oh, this must be yelling at callers?
Yeah, I don't remember having one other than the fact that I sort of risked where I was and comfy. Certainly not ripped, but comfy. I mean, the salary had gone up a little bit with the column and so forth,
yeah.
but I had already lost the column. Right. I wasn't sure. That's the honest-to-God answer because we know Chicago's a great sports town. There's no doubt about that. So, I mean, there's always that part of me that goes, well, of course people are going to listen sooner or later. I mean, if they can. And then when the frequency changed to 1160, I found out later on they still couldn't hear in Lombard or the western suburb. So it's like
it's the early days of building a radio station.
Yeah,
right?
For the long time we were strictly fighting uphill. It was a battle that I wasn't ever sure we were going to win. And I think others might have been more positive about it than I was. Certainly when the station was purchased, they were positive than I was about it. But for all in my heart, I felt this would work in Chicago. How could it not? How could a city this passionate about sports not take to an all-sports station? Early returns weren't encouraging. And by 99, when the change was made, when all the partnerships were rearranged and everything, the numbers were down again. And nobody could figure out why. 7 years into it, seven and a half, actually, August of 1999, they just called me in and said, you know, we're going to change.
Change it up.
No more Dan McNeil, Dan Bernstein, who's been covering the Bears and other reporting for the station. And it's like, you're being told 7.5 years into it, you're a failure. Failed again. You failed again. I mean, you still have the job. But you failed again. And I mean, for me, and this is probably just the way I was, but failure always weighs more heavily with me than success does. I look at success and celebrity and all that stuff as a kind of a, okay, if you say so. I find it hard to believe and hard to deal with sometimes because I don't. Understanding, what I've learned more than anything else is guys like you and everybody else who does radio anywhere, you really have an effect on people. You don't realize it. I'm not trying to affect people, but somehow I clearly did, as you and others, thousands of others who had that same effect on people. You just don't ever dream in your wildest dreams that people would be that close, that much attentive to a guy talking sports or care that much or want to know more, all this other stuff. So I still find it amazing when you read the stuff and you say, he did this and he did that, and and I'm going, oh, God, I really don't feel any of that. But one thing I've learned is the personal connection to radio is really something. It really is something.
The idea of failure, where do you think that comes from? Where do you think that comes? Because a lot of this book is split between the professional Terry Bors and the personal. We get
and
to
the
know
crazy,
about your,
yeah, the crazy one, yeah,
know about
the,
your relationships,
the goofy one,
with your parents, with your wife.
I just think that my fallback is always I failed. It took me a long time to be happy with doing the radio. Probably 95 when we were doing okay, and I started to feel better about it because you consistently worry. The failure of it. When something happens, I always kind of feel like it's my fault. I mean, I'm working with a guy who not born in radio, but he did radio for a long time. He worked for Chet for 11 years, Dan McNeil. So it isn't him. It must be me. I mean, I don't think he thinks he failed because he was him being himself. That's who he is. If you listen to that, that's exactly who he was. And I thought I was being me, but if that me was no good, then whose fault is that? It's me. I guess the best way I dealt with failure is I always just blame myself. I mean, it isn't for my parents. My mother never did. She cut me slack on the stupid stuff I did. My dad did, too. I always sort of felt like, where was I going, and when was I ever going to get there? I had four kids by then, and because my last sons were born in 1983, the twins. I looked at it, and I said, well, I haven't failed as a father yet, I don't think. Some people think I failed at newspapers. Some people think I failed at radio. So, I mean, the career is sort of marked by more failure than it is success to me. I mean, I look at it and I say, well, I made people mad at the Sun-Times for something I didn't really intend to do. And I still don't believe I did it. I'd have to find the column and read it over again to say that.
Is this the Marlboro Man stuff?
That clever? I couldn't write that. That wasn't it at all. I mean, I'd happily say, yeah, I'm so clever I tried to get that. I didn't try to do that. I guess my fallback has always been, look, if there's something wrong, don't look around. Yeah. Don't be a thumb guy. Yeah, me.
Apologies to who you had dinner with. I forgot towards the end of the book, but they talked about that you have to look at life as a win.
Jerry DiNardo.
But that was a big part of the philosophy of what you take away from your career.
Mm-hmm.
That regardless of everything else that happened, the station, everything else, your life, Terry Bors, is a win.
Yeah, it is a win. And I took Jerry. I'd never heard that expression before. I must be so far out of touch with reality.
No, I didn't hear it either.
But when he said that to me, he said, I know what you're worried about. You've already won at life. And I thought about that later on. And he's such a great guy, such a terrific guy. Not unlike a lot of college football coaches, you know, who you have to wash your hands when you get done with him. Is there a towel handy? Can I just leave now? He's a genuinely good guy. And when he says it, a guy who's obviously succeeded to a very high level, but I think when he said that, it finally helped me straighten my head out a little bit. It really did. And I told my wife, I said, you know, I don't want to declare a win at this point. She said, no, you did. You won. You won. She said, look around you.
Four kids through college?
Yeah. She said, we got all four of them through college.
But I mean, those are the benchmarks.
And none of them
are
as goofy as I am, so it's a great thing helping you not
win,
being such an idiot. Yeah. When he said that, I thought about that the entire night, and I think I mentioned that to her the next day. That, you know, do you think I won at life? And she goes, what? And now I definitely do. I feel like against all odds, because there's really nothing that makes me special about anything, that I have somehow I did. And I'm not sure if you said, how could you do that all over again? Not at my age. I could not do that all over again.
Terry Bors in studio. The book is The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. And, you know, there's a lot I want to get to, and we'll probably run out of time. But I want to talk about when you knew, and maybe you never did, but when you knew that this format was taking off. If by 99, 7.5 years in, you're like, I don't know if this is working, and everyone's shuffling stuff around. When did you know? Also, what makes a great sports talk radio host? But the big thing I want to get to, because I don't want to miss this, is just, you know, with your health and the fact that you were diagnosed, it's kind of after the, you know, you had health issues, and out of those health issues, you were diagnosed with cancer, and out of that came chemotherapy and radiation. And in a way, came very close to robbing you of really what you wanted, which is to come back to the radio.
Mm-hmm. It did.
Take us to that spot. Take us to that moment of being a guy who knows all the sports cliches and knows everything about what sports means to us as people, and how you applied covering the sport and doing everything to having the fight of your lifetime.
The funny thing about the fight of your lifetime is that, you know, I spent a lifetime reading about guys who fought cancer, women who fought cancer, whatever. I mean, we're pretty aware of it. And I'm self-aware enough to know that, well, okay, I mean, that's my diagnosis. That wasn't what it was going in. That's what it turned out to be. And I was eager to get back to it. But I found that those days after the surgery, I had a June 16th of 2017, the first one. I had a second surgery on November 1st of 2017.
2016.
Or 2016, yeah. Sorry. You want to get back to what you do, because we're not physical guys. We're not out lifting concrete blocks. We're just talking. But I couldn't do that. I couldn't guarantee anybody that next day. I couldn't guarantee you 10 minutes down the road that I'd be well enough to do it. It was just so strange, the recovery. You know, I had a house full of nurses and people and feeding tubes and all the other stuff that I think once you – I had planned on retiring anyway, but I wanted to get back sooner because I knew the Cubs were going to be in the World Series. I knew it. I felt it the entire season. I knew it. So I checked the date of when the World Series started, which was October 24th, 2016. I said, okay, I'm going to be back by then. I did. I worked that week, and I literally collapsed by Friday. We had a remote downtown here, and I just was so far out of it. I mean, I was still in so much pain, and I walked back to the train, and I said, I can't, you know, I made it through the week, but my face was still swollen about two times normal size. I just had the other surgery, or another surgery was coming. I went back to the hospital, forced my way in, and said, you got to do something about this. This isn't working because I'm out to here. So it was very difficult for the job we do to say, well, I can't do that. That sounds like you're being the biggest sissy in the world. I can't do that. And I couldn't. I couldn't possibly be reliable enough to say, well, no, don't worry about that. I'll be there in 2 weeks. I learned over a period of time there that I just couldn't say that anymore. I can't. It would be easier to just say, you know what, give me a month or give me 2 months or whatever. Because I, as much as my heart wanted to come back, right, and I really wanted to be back, I couldn't.
Did you have to come to terms with that? Did you have
I did. It was very difficult because you find out when they take away what you do. And it was taken away. Clearly, for me to be in front of a microphone 5 hours a day just wasn't going to happen. It just was not going to happen. And I thought, well, okay, next week I'll feel better. Let's talk on Monday. We'll see how we're doing. No, it never, you know, so I started thinking more in terms of months or weeks. And then for a while I wasn't sure. And then when this thing was swollen up again and I knew I needed more surgery, at least I was going to go ask for it, because they wouldn't do anything about it right away. I just had a feeling that that was it. There's no way, even now, if somebody said to me, you want to do a show? No, I couldn't promise you that. I feel good most days now. I'm pretty good, much better. I think I'm over the chemo, and then the radiation takes an effect on you that really I think people don't quite understand how awful it is until you've had it done. And I had it in the face, so... it robs you of everything you've ever worked for, everything you've ever done. You don't even have the energy to sit down and write. If even I want to sit down and write, just say I would just want to write a column or write something for the website, I couldn't do it.
Does this book that just came out in November, does it mean more to you with the feelings and emotions that you were just talking about, the idea that you're not sure you're going to be able to even write?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, I when I came back last year, we left for the winter and came back in April. And I had made the promise to everybody, really, that I was writing this book. So I thought, well, if I sit down every day and write 2,000 words, reasonable, in 6 weeks, I got a lot of words. I got a lot of words to go. But you can't have that day where you say, I can't write anymore.
Yeah.
You can't let it get you, even though I was in pain and it was still bothering me. But I still had attendants coming over. I still had people coming over. I still had physical therapy stuff I had to do and all the other things. I still found time to sit down and write those 2,000 words a day. Did they always make sense? Probably not. But that I could do. And it convinced me that, yeah, you can do this. You can do this. And the one thing you can't do is just say, I don't feel like it today. You know, we don't have a job where you say, I don't feel like it today. I mean, you just, it's not that kind of job. We should be grateful and thankful for what we do for a living, because that's really what it is. It's a blessing. It's not a curse. It's not anything else. And I sort of look at it and say, well, writing was a great help for me. It helped me. It was a great thing to sit down and put all this crap together. And it helped me a great deal mentally, because it proved to me that I can still do something. If I can't ever talk again for a period of time, if I can't ever do whatever I want to for a period of time again. Because when you're going through this, you question it. You just wonder, am I ever going to be anything close to normal again? Am I ever going to be the guy I once was, or even, because I lost 50 pounds. Uh-huh. Went from 225 to 177. I mean, I was physically unable to do, you know, much of anything. Had a feeding tube. There's not, you can't really pig out on a feeding tube. So I questioned everything. So writing was actually therapy. It was actually therapy for me. I also have made it my habit over the years to keep a promise. And if I promise somebody I'm going to do something, I'm going to do it.
To think that the score of 25 years, 2017, to think of a sports radio format in Chicago, do you look back on that? Do you look back on your career at the score and recognize the contributions and the legacy that you leave behind? Because there is no sports radio without Terry Bores. You have had your name, your voice, your imprint, everything on it, everything that Chicago's done for a quarter of a century.
See, I still struggle to cope with that, with praise. I think that, you know, sports radio will go on forever in this town, and there will always be sports talk radio in this town, and there will always be somebody to do it. And the score has done so much for me as well. I mean, they've helped me in all countless ways and always have, that I don't feel that way. See, one of the guys I love took my place. The guy that produced for us, I loved it. And I mean, when I left, I said, got to give this job to Jason. I mean, Jason deserves the job. And eventually he did get it. Wasn't my recommendation, I'm sure. And you make up your own mind. But no, I kind of look at it like a lot of old entertainers that, you know, there's always somebody come along that somebody's going to love more. That's okay. I mean, I've watched people for decades now, and I always say, meh. I'm on doing my bucket list now, the things I want to do for myself right before I go. So I when I look at this, I say, over a period of time, they'll forget. Generations change, people change, and all of that changes. And maybe there'll always be a Terry Bores way at the station, that sort of thing. But no, I don't ever think that my imprint is such that it'll always be there. I look at guys who did a hell of a lot more than I did with their lives. And, you know, if you really make a lasting imprint, you're very lucky. And you're also way above my pay scale. So, I mean, I don't think that's true. But sports talk is not going away. And that makes me proud that at least that much of it is not going away.
It's awesome to hear your voice. It's awesome to meet you as a longtime listener to you for years. It's a pleasure to read the book, The Score of a Lifetime, 25 years talking Chicago sports. Terry Bores in studio. Terry, a pleasure. Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
I was reading the Tribune earlier in the carryout. I mentioned the couple who was, I should say, allegedly robbed on Lower Wacker. I think it was last night. News story says charges were pending against the out-of-town couple who falsely claimed they were robbed at knife point. They say knife point. It's like knife point's kind of a weird gun point, yeah. Knife point.
That actually makes more sense with knife point.
Yeah, knife point is a point, right? Maybe it should be gun point. We
gun
the question.
Circle.
Yeah. Gun chamber. Yeah, they told officers they took GPS directions to Lower Wacker, 300 North Columbus Drive around 1:50 a.m. They said three people approached him with a knife, took their engagement ring, their suitcase purse, a laptop, a suitcase, and an iPad mini. The two were in police custody Thursday evening, and charges were pending against them for filing false police reports. Wow. The incident has determined to be unfounded. So there you go. Fake news. False news? This is not fake news, false news. But yeah, wow. There you go. You know what? I would like to take this moment to apologize to Lower Wacker Drive for my comments in the carryout saying that I would never go down there. Now I think it's okay at 2 a.m. Go now. Have at it. Have fun. Enjoy yourself down in the catacombs that is the wondrous mystery and maze that is Lower Wacker Drive after 2 a.m. I apologize. Lower Wacker, please forgive me. All right, coming up, David Yarrow is going to join us, wildlife photographer, noted. He's got a new show here in Chicago that's running through January at the Hilton Asmus Contemporary Gallery. It's amazing. It's amazing. David Yarrow is one of the best photographers working, capturing lions mid-jump or grizzly bears in Alaska the sharks off the coast of South Africa. This guy has one of the greatest jobs in the world. We'll talk with him coming up here on The Download. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, my next guest has one of the best jobs on the planet, mostly because it's his job to document the wildlife on said planet. World-renowned photographer David Yarrow has a new exhibit of his work up at the Hilton Asmus Contemporary Gallery at 716 North Wells in the River North neighborhood. Yarrow's photography is nothing short of amazing. Catching a lion in mid-jump, or finding himself and his camera up close and personal with a grizzly bear in Alaska, or one of his most recent gigs going to Tsavo in East Africa to document the dwindling population of the tusker elephants. It's breathtaking work from a photographer and artist that not only captures these amazing animals in their habitat, but goes a long way in helping us better understand these species that walk alongside us. David Yarrow is a photographer, philanthropist, an author, conservationist, and he's my guest at the big table. David, great to have you. Thanks for being here.
It's great to be in Chicago. What a great city.
This exhibit, the Chicago debut, how does this come about? How does an exhibit come about when you really, truly do so many things around the world?
Well, I guess the great thing about your country is that there are so many great cities to show in. And unlike in the UK, where there's London and then there's a bit of a gap to Manchester or Edinburgh or Glasgow, where I'm right. from, or Leeds, in America there's so many powerful cities that have a sense of cultural assurity. They don't need to all go to Washington or New York to see their art. And we knew Chicago was a great city where people were sophisticated, where there was an appetite for the arts, and hopefully an appetite for my kind of photography. It's then a question of finding a gallery that where the gallery right. owners shares our passion, is professional in what they do. And rather than us hustling around trying to find the gallery, we kind of wait until they come and try and find us.
You know, you have had such a tremendous career, not just with wildlife. Sports was a big part of your career when you started. I'm fascinated about the idea of really making that transition in your career from photographer to artist, in the way that the photography that you do now, I mean, it almost looks like a painting in the way that you're looking at stuff, and it just is perfect for the gallery, especially the gallery here in Chicago. Talk about that from at one point going on assignment and working for newspapers or other places to now being in a position where you're actually showing it as art.
It's been a long journey. It certainly hasn't been an overnight thing. I'm in the spring of the autumn of my life, or maybe the autumn of the summer of my life, something like that.
But something like that.
I think when I was photographing, I did the Winter Olympics in Calgary way back in 1988. And I remember that I had a moment, my epiphany maybe, where I thought I'd taken a decent picture of a German bobsleigh team. And I got back to the editing studio. And of course, there were 20 German photographers that had got the same picture of the bobsleigh team. Mm-hmm. And I worried then that maybe in sports photography there was a little bit of an imbalance between the supply of good photographs and the demand, which was steady for good photographs. And that was going to manifest itself in probably lower prices and maybe less of an appreciation than there should be of mm-hmm. the photographers who are taking those pictures. So I got slightly disillusioned. And at its core was the principle that if you're sitting with a bank of photographers, like you might have the Blackhawks or the Cubs or the Bears, if there are 200 photographers photographing it, how can you be unique? How can you get something that isn't just bog-standard reportage? How can you get something that's art? So at a young age, I was already getting kind of itchy feet. I think it's also an extent to which you photograph what you're interested in. Mm-hmm. And like any teenager, I was very interested in sport, so it was entirely natural for me to photograph sport. Also, I think you photograph best what you know best. So then I went into a period of photographing women, not to say that I know women at all well. I mean, how can you possibly know women? But I tried my very best. But also, there are a lot of people photographing women. And then as I got older, I got more interested in landscape. It's kind of, your life sort of dumbs down. And the problem with landscape is it's always there. Your country has extraordinary landscape, but it is always there.
And
it's quite accessible. So the person that takes the best pictures tends to be the person that arrives at those landscapes in the most extraordinary weather conditions rather than necessarily the most proficient.
Right, you're not necessarily catching an action.
No.
Yeah.
I think that a big moment for me was probably about 8-9 years ago photographing great white sharks off the coast of South Africa.
And As one does.
Just a regular Saturday. And I spent about 30 hours in the water and eventually I wanted a picture of them predating rather than in the sea, underwater, because we live our life on land. So kind of underwater photography, whilst it's very interesting, it's not really art because we can't really relate to it. There'll be some that will disagree, but that's fine. I wanted a shark coming out of the water trying to catch something, like a surfer or a seal or whatever. And it turned out to be a seal. And when I got the picture, it was printed everywhere. And then my check for the picture was probably around about, when it came through, it was probably around about $16,000. And I calculated, wow. I calculated it cost me $20,000 to take the picture.
Yeah, right. So
I'd actually lost, and I'd created the world's worst business model. And then it just happened that a lawyer from Houston said he wanted to have a fine art print of it. And he ended up buying three for, I think, $18,000. And that's when the penny dropped. That was my Jerry Maguire moment when I knew that.
You know, here's what I want to do, David. Let's take a break because I want to come back and talk about being relatable is one. But also when you talk about wanting to take a great photo, it's really to understand the subject, to also understand the area. You talked about it with sports. So we'll talk about what you had to do to better understand the world that you are now immersed in, whether it be the great white shark or the lions and the Tusker elephants. David Yarrow, world-renowned, award-winning photographer, philanthropist, author, conservationist. He's got a new exhibit at the Hilton Asmus Contemporary Gallery at 716 North Wells in the River North area. It's up through January. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. David Yarrow in studio. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest, The Big Table, and it's great to have David Yarrow in studio, world-renowned photographer, philanthropist, author, conservationist. He has a new exhibit, the debut exhibit here in Chicago at the Hilton Asmus Contemporary Gallery at 716 North Wells in the River North neighborhood, running through January. You know, before the break, you mentioned, you know, with sports as a teenager, you knew a lot about sports. So it helped you understand how to shoot sports. Mm-hmm. When you made the transition to say, I'm going to get into wildlife, I'm going to take pictures of lions and tigers and bears and elephants and great white shark, what'd you have to do to get yourself prepared?
I think the first thing, the platform, was I looked at a lot of the pictures of others. And Ansel Adams, one of your great photographers, said that photography is not about a camera, and he's dead right. He said it's about the poems you've read, the music you've listened to, the loves you've lost, the loves you've made, and the photographs of others. And I became a little bit of a sponge to the things that other people had got right, the things they got wrong, the things that I got wrong. I think the big mistake so many people make in photography is they're not close enough. The great war photographer Robert Capper said, if the picture's not good enough, it's because you're not close enough. And, you know, and he landed on Omaha Beach on D-Day, and his photography was very immersive. And I think we live in an era now where immersive cinematography and immersive photography works. Like the film The Revenant, a lot of The Revenant was shot 2 or 3 foot from Tom Hardy's face or DiCaprio's face.
Yeah.
And a lot of practitioners in wildlife photography, I think, haven't got round the riddle of proximity. How do you get close to things that could kill you? And therefore, they were photographing beautiful things from 150 yards away. You're never going to photograph Kate Moss from 150 yards away. You're going to photograph her from 2 feet away. And you could argue a lion is as beautiful as someone like Kate Moss. So it is a question of finding your ways around that, whether that be with technology, whether it be through a modicum of bravery. But largely it's through research, relentlessness, tenacity. And for different animals, you do different things. So I started off with lions by scenting the cameras so that the lion would come to the camera. Luckily, they don't know who Tom Ford is, so you don't have to use really expensive aftershave. But I used a really cheap British deodorant called Old Spice, which saved me a fortune, because the English colonialists, when they came over to East Africa, wore Old Spice, and therefore the Maasai started to wear Old Spice, and so the lions are
familiar with it.
So I would just cake my cameras in Old Spice, and more often than not, they would come up to the camera. And more often than not, then they'd take the camera away with them, in it, even though it was in a massive metal box. And I would be 100 yards away. So I was irrelevant. They weren't interested in me. They were interested in the box. And that started to work. So that gave me the first encouragement that this was. And also, when you have a camera, place it on the ground, it is so much better perspective than being 5 foot in the air.
That's what's amazing about your work, perspective.
You've got to always have your eyes or the camera's lens lower than the eyes of the animal. There's no point photographing a polar bear from a boat because people immediately know you're in a boat. So it looks like you could just as well be in a cruise ship. So it was a question of getting around that riddle, which is different for each animal. And because I've just done it an awful lot now, I still make mistakes and I've had some interesting moments. And in your country, I was trying to photograph bisons. And I did a lot of work, and it's such an emblematic American animal. And the key feature of the bison is its head. It's kind of primeval. It's prehistoric looking. And the shape of that head front on. But if you try and get 2 foot from a bison, you've got to be careful. They're big guys up in Yellowstone, and they could easily have a go at you. And right. That's with the size of their head, you've got a problem.
As a wildlife photographer, and obviously you're talking about, you know, technology, being able to be remote, you'd be 100 yards away. But I would assume even being 100 yards away, at one point you're like, well, maybe I'll be 50 yards away. Do you have to, I mean, is it a lot of trial and error of how to deal with predators?
I guess it's an iterative process in that you're always re-examining your work and knowing how you can tweak it. The big difference between doing what I do now and using the examples of professional sports, say in Chicago, is the one thing that unites all my pictures is I'm the only person there. So you're not learning it off any other photographers in the field right. because I usually have a sort of panic attack if there's another photographer within a square mile of where I am. You think, what the hell are you doing here, you idiot? You learn along the way, and there's no guidebooks. But all the time I'm encouraged by the fact that no one in this world in 2017, I think, transcends by continuing to do what's been done in the past. You've got to rip up the rule book and go the other way, go 180 degrees to what people have done before. That's how I think you can make a difference. And I have a great fear of the mundane. I have a great sort of sense of insecurity that my work could be boring or doesn't pass across that threshold. And the one way to make sure that it does is to get so close that the pictures become really evocative and stare into the soul of the animals.
It's amazing to me because we talked about relatability, right? We never get a chance to look this close at a lion. Grizzly bear in Alaska. There's this idea that I was looking at his feet.
Yeah.
And the nails.
Yeah,
and,
they're kind of primeval. I think that in that case, in that particular case, their paws are just ridiculously big and they're a core characteristic of the animal. But I think with all animals, maybe other than the polar bear, where their eyes are fairly sinister, the eyes are absolutely critical. If you're thinking about your son or your wife, the first thing you'll think about is their eyes. If we think about our friends, the first thing we think about is their eyes. They define someone, whether they're kind, whether they've got a mean streak, whether they're happy or whether they're sad. And animals are exactly the same. And if you photograph from a long way away, it's very difficult to get a sense of what their eyes are like. So that's my starting point in everything I do, is to home in on, even with an elephant, with such a vast animal, if the eye is not pin sharp, I'm not interested in the photograph.
Another thing that I would assume comes with the territory is patience. You're part stalking to find these, as the example you mentioned with, you know, scenting the cameras. But, I mean, there's probably a lot of waiting and patience, and especially when you're the only one out there. And talk about those moments of patience and solitary confinement, if you will, in the middle of such a vast wonderland in nature.
I think it's true of a lot of people that are involved in original content gathering, that retrospectively they embellish either the danger they're in or the amount of hours that they spend. I actually think the most amount of patience I show is leaving Nairobi Airport, because you go through about five different security checks, and that really is real patience. I mean, when you finally think you've when you've finally gone through the fourth time that they ask you to empty your bag, and then there's another one right around the corner, that's real patience. I think with animals, I tend to photograph either very early in the morning or late in the day, particularly in Africa where the sun's high. So you do have a limited window. So like if I'm trying to photograph lions in Africa, I will be up at 4 and I'll be back to wherever my base camp is at 8 because the sun's too high. Mm. And same in the evening. So it's not like you're sitting out there waiting.
Right. It's not like days
all day. And when we get the picture and we think we're wrapped, we go straight home. And my secretary or PA, I don't know how she's still with me, because I change so many flights on a regular basis because I really do want to get home. But equally, there's sometimes you do go home with nothing. Right. One of the other issues of photography in 2017, at a time when we're all spoiled with content, is a lot of photographers, I think, make the mistake of addressing plurality with their own plurality. So they think because there's a lot of content around, I've got to offer a lot of content too.
See that all the time on Instagram and other places. Yeah.
So the idea of, let's say, a professional photographer, let's say he goes up that hill in Peru and comes down again 10 days later, and then he posts 100 pictures on his website. He's kind of implicitly saying that he took 10, 15 great pictures a day, or one great picture every waking hour. That's a nonsense. If I can take 4 good pictures a year, that's my goal.
Wow.
I think in 2016, I took one. And I know I'm tough on myself.
Is that the thing? Take the pictures and you just don't like them?
I just don't think they're strong enough. And I work with Victoria's Secrets quite a bit. They have an expression called Kennedy Dead. Kennedy Dead basically is a reference to picking up your newspaper on the 23rd of November, 63, and reading Kennedy Dead. It just stops you in your tracks. It gathers your attention, and then it holds your attention. It's intoxicating. You can't get away from it. That's the kind of picture you need to take. And almost by definition, you can't take that many a year. I think maybe this year we might have taken 5 or 6, which is an above-average year for me.
David Yarrow, the world-renowned photographer, philanthropist, author, conservationist. We'll talk about that coming up here. His Chicago debut of a great collection of photography is at the Hilton Asmus Contemporary Gallery at 716 North Wells here in town, the River North neighborhood. David Yarrow in town. Let's take a break. We'll get the news. We'll come back. More with David Yarrow at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. My guest in studio, the world-renowned photographer, David Yarrow. He's got a new exhibit at the Hilton Asmus Contemporary Gallery at 716 North Wells in the River North neighborhood, running through January. We're talking about his work, which is The Wild Encounters is the name of the exhibit. As you've mentioned throughout this interview, it's not all you do. I mean, you've done so many different, even to the point of going to North Korea, to other places, to document what's happening. Mm-hmm. But at the core, and what's really, really impressive about your work is that, as you just told us before the news, this idea that you are taking 4 or 5 pictures a year, and you can see it. When I see the picture of the lion, I'm like, that's amazing. Pete and I are looking at it in the office. I'm like, I've never seen a picture like that. And it makes sense now that you need to say, yeah, I take 5 pictures a year because I have to get it right. Do you see it that way? And when you're deciding to go to North Korea or you're going to go to somewhere else in the world, to Alaska or, like you said, the bison in Yellowstone, you already have your mindset that you're like, all right, it's going to be one picture and I got to get that picture.
There is a bit of a preconception. You don't want to put yourself in a straitjacket. We do 2 types of photographs. We do ones where we're totally in the wild. And it's like going to Vegas in that whatever happens on the pool table, on the roulette table, you can't be in control of it. And it's a crapshoot. And then we do stage photography where there is more of a linear route from your preconception through to your conception. Yeah. In fact, we're coming back to Chicago, I hope, soon to do a shoot. And that's going to be a preconceived concept that we have. But generally, I have an idea. The starting point is when we talk about animals, we say, Let's imagine the elephant. Mm-hmm. We say, what are the most remarkable features of the elephant? Well, the tusks. So for me to go and photograph in an area of Africa where the gene pool doesn't allow for the tusks to be big would immediately raise questions. I'd want to go places where the gene pool ensures that the tusks, which are the kind of key core feature of the elephant, are big. So that's the starting point. And if it's somewhere that's inaccessible, untamed, difficult, then we have to work out how we're going to get around that.
Mm-hmm.
We're in a lucky position now because when we go on a project, we spend a lot of time researching.
Yeah.
And also we can throw a little bit of money at it. When we were recently in Kenya photographing these sort of half mammoth, half elephant beasts, they're just quite magnificent. Savo is about... I was going to say 2/3 the size of whales, but you don't really know what whale size is, so that's a ridiculous analogy to make.
I think
here.
We do.
Say it's probably about whales. It's probably about the size of. I would say it's not far off the size of Illinois. Okay. So, on that basis, trying to find an elephant in Illinois, I'm sure this is the start of a joke. How do you find an elephant in Illinois? it's not easy.
Right.
So we worked with conservationists over there that have crop spraying planes, just bush planes. And they knew where 2 or 3 of them were. So 5 o'clock in the morning, we'd get up, get into the bush plane and just tour, going up and down, looking, because elephants don't tend to move an awful lot, particularly when it's hot, and they'll stay close to watering holes. Mm-hmm. So much of my work is based around where the water is, and because animals have to drink. And being a Scotsman, I know all about that.
You know, David, it's fascinating to listen to you talk, because even with the planning process, the research that goes into it, everything that you don't think about when you're trying to get this picture, when you're looking at a picture, a lot of it has to do with improvisation. You have to have a mindset, almost a yes-and idea of the way that you're approaching things. You have to be set in the way that, yes, this is the way you want things to go, but animals are not, they're not getting made up. Not like, it's time for my shoot.
It's not Hollywood, no.
Talk about that. Talk about how you've had to develop that persona and your personality to say, I got to go with the flow.
Yeah, I mean, there's no doubt that the evolution from film to digital has helped us, because in the days of film, you could do no immediate feedback. So let's imagine on assignment, you didn't know what you had. Yeah. Sure, you could use a Polaroid camera, but that's only going to check your light and your composition. With digital, you get immediate feedback that night. And it, like all filmmakers, like photographers, you review your work.
That's
in the
huge,
evening,
yeah.
And you sit down over a glass of whiskey and you go, I've got it wrong. These are the three reasons I've got it wrong. And tomorrow we will get it, we'll do it better. Then if the content isn't there, the next day you just wait. So there is a constant sort of circular process.
An editing process.
Yeah, of improvement. And because I know animal behavior well, most animal behaviors, well, I that's easier. Animals are fairly predictable. They're lazy, they sleep, they eat, and really, that's about it for radio. But they do spend a lot of the time using the least amount of energy as possible. And they have to drink as well, so that's why watering holes are important. The polar bears are tough. And they're dangerous. And there's really only kind of four places in the world to photograph polar bears well. There's Siberia, there's islands off the north of Siberia. Then there's the archipelago to the north of Norway called Svalbard. And then there's a place you'll be familiar with, Churchill, which has become a bit of a tourist resort. Mm-hmm. And then there's the North Slope of Alaska. And the North Slope of Alaska, near Prudhoe Bay, is very special because no one really knows how to get up there unless you're an oil guy. And when you get up there, there's really no accommodation. And I remember going up there for the first time and staying in a porta cabin, like a container thing. And there's a little window to look out of. And when I looked out, going up and down the street, there were 25 polar bears. So you can't actually go outside at that moment in time. But then trying to work out how you're going to get those pictures. But there's a kind of period of time in September when the Inuits are allowed to bring a couple of whales in because they're whale hunters, and I think that's quite right that that's continued to be allowed. And during that time, the bears almost take on a different persona in that they kind of think they're in collaboration with the humans a little bit, and they know that the humans are bringing in the whales and the humans are helping them because they can eat off the whalebone.
For a while, yeah.
And you can get close then. Oh, and I have got close to polar bears where I actually managed to take a selfie of myself in the polar bear's eyes, which was an interesting moment.
The idea of being a wildlife photographer, and there is this crossover into conservationism where you are a journalist, but you're also you document the world around us and wildlife. The question I have is just about the contrast and the collaboration between the world of trying to conserve what you're photographing and being objective and saying, I got to move on from this place.
Yeah, I mean, the whole conservation issue is a tricky one, because no matter how much money we can raise in a year from the sale of our photographs, and we'll probably get over $1 million this year, it would be ridiculously obtuse to think that that $1 million is going to make any difference at all. It doesn't make things worse. I think what does make a great deal of difference is the content in the photographs, which can then raise awareness. Because zoos, we have this debate about zoos, and people that disapprove of zoos, I think it's desperately elitist, because the vast majority of people in Chicago are never going to be able to afford to or have the time to go to some of the places that I go to. So if that's ruled out, how are they going to have any relationship with animals? It's going to be through zoos. And so the best zoos, of which many are in America, they raise awareness, they can also potentially breed, and they can do research. And I think all those things are important. If I leave an ecosystem and garner content from it, and I don't give anything back. I think that's a little bit spiritually bankrupt as well. So I'm in a fortunate position that I can do that, and the pictures sell for enough that if people buy them for conservation, then a good chunk does go back into Africa. There's a huge misplaced sense of romanticism about Africa. It's, for a start, it's vast. It's just so vast. If you look at a global map, it's just huge. And it's also four continents wrapped into one. It's the Arabic North, the oil-rich West, and East Africa, then Sub-Saharan Africa. But the thing that unites all four components, I'm afraid, is deep corruption from the top right down to the bottom. So the people that say, isn't Africa wonderful? I think what they're referring to are these kind of pockets of serenity that have the greatest shows on earth of wildlife. Right. They're not talking about downtown Burkina Faso on a Saturday night. I don't think there's anything hugely romantic about that. And there's some very tough parts of Africa. But there are these wonderful places that our grandchildren, your son's son or daughter, should be able to see. And right now, particularly the lion, there's a chance that your grandchildren will not see a lion in the wild, which really is a shocking legacy that we're leaving as tenants of the planet.
Your work is tremendous, and you've been doing it for you. What's next for you? I mean, I think about this because, you know, you talked at the beginning about having an interest in the subject, and that's what makes great photography. Is there an area or an interest in an animal or wildlife that you're like, I really want to get that on film?
Yeah, I mean, I wrestle with that all the time. The Holy Grail in photography is relevance. I'm sure that resonates with you because you want to be relevant in what you're doing on a nightly basis, and that must be very tough. So conservation is relevant. That's the reason I went to North Korea. It's very relevant right now. It's probably named in most people's conversations every night. And yeah. I thought, well, if I got a chance to get access and go in there, and I'm hoping to go back, I'm hoping to get a chance to maybe photograph the Supreme Leader. And I think that would be a very relevant thing to do. Maybe demystify him slightly, give him a personality to the West. Obviously, the red tape involved in doing that.
Yeah,
the easiest bit's going to be taking the picture. The hard bit's actually getting in position to take the picture.
David Yarrow's new exhibit is the Chicago debut of Wild Encounters is at the Hilton Asmus Contemporary Gallery at 716 North Wells in the River North neighborhood. It's up till January. World-renowned photographer, philanthropist, author, conservationist. David Yarrow, a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for sharing your story in the Big Ten.
Great to be in Chicago. Thank you.
All right. David Yarrow, great photographer. Stuff online. Look it up, Yarrow. Or go on over to the Hilton Asmus Contemporary Gallery at 716 North Wells. It's right over here in the River North area. It's right a part of the gallery scene here in Chicago. I'd like to know more about those places. Also, and I forget which street it is, diagonal parking. It always throws me for a loop. Yeah, one of the streets over here, an Erie or one, like over, I think, by Franklin, or whatever it is in that area. But yeah, it's you take a right turn and there's diagonal parking. You're like, what is this? How does this exist? How did the gallery area have so much clout? They must have got to Burton and Terrace early. You know? Sure, I'll make it diagonal for you. There's got to be a history, right? Find out the history of why they've got diagonal parking on a city street in the River North area. David Yarrow, that's awesome. The recent stuff he did with the Tusker elephants is amazing. The lion stuff is breathtaking. The grizzly bears in Alaska is just, I mean, everything he does. It's mind-blowing to me. This is why I think that he is a tremendous artist. The humility to say, I probably get 4 good photos a year.
He said... The goal is to get 4. He said, like last year, he only had 2.
It's amazing, right? And he's right. I mean, think about it. If you were going to put that much money, effort, everything into climbing the mountain, getting to a certain spot, don't you think that you would be like, this one's okay?
Yes, of course. Good enough.
Maybe the animal's not looking right at me, but it's close enough. Let's see.
It was really fascinating too. Yeah, just telling like how he goes with the process about he knows like where to go because the water. He knows what time because he knows when they're going to be out. And
I love the anecdote as well about he's too early is dousing his cameras and equipment in Old Spice because that's what the British settlers used back in the early days of Africa, and that's where the lions would want to hunt.
Yeah.
So he would douse it in Old Spice, not unlike a guy who at T-Box this weekend. That's Axe body spray now.
Yeah.
Same concept.
And sometimes the animal would walk away with the camera.
It's like, oh, I'm going to eat this like my ancestors did.
I remember when I was a kid, when I had hair, I put hairspray in, and I remember bees would flock to this hairspray. There was always bees around my head. I'm like, isn't that hairspray?
Isn't that a thing where they're like, don't put deodorant or hairspray on when you're going to hike in Yellowstone because it attracts the animals and the insects and stuff? Well, good show tonight. Also, awesome to have Terry Bores. That was awesome. I'm talking about he's going to play softball.
Dante Bichette. That's a great name.
There were so many. It's a great one. So awesome. I'm going to bring that back. There were so many great texters during that segment that were all, you know, asking about very specific Terry Bores information. Tell him, what does he think of Spuds? Spuds from Frankfurt. Used to call all the time. Spuds. I'm not going to ask him. And then also at the beginning, Gary Oldman. What a good show tonight.
That's incredible.
And now we make a transition in the 10 o'clock hour to talk about the holidays.
I know, I should have bells.
I know, right? I'm very excited to talk with our Christmatologist, Pete Zimmerman, about how to Christmas so hard this weekend, and that we're going to do this each week leading up to the Christmas holiday. But Chicago has so much to offer, and there's new stuff and old stuff, tradition and contemporary, and things tucked away and other things right here on Michigan Avenue. Mm-hmm. That sometimes you need a little help, a little guidance, a little curation to understand what you might want to do if you have some open and free time this upcoming weekend. So we'll do that with Pete coming up here in the 10 o'clock hour.
And I like to do a new thing every year. I like to come up with one or two new things every year. So if people have recommendations.
That's amazing to me.
Out in the suburbs where I'm not really familiar with.
Yeah, 312-981-7200. Where should Pete go?
Yeah.
I mean, it's serious. If you follow Pete on social media or just in life, you see that he's, I mean, for around the Christmas holiday, he's doing it all.
Yeah.
The rest of the year, he doesn't do anything.
No.
It's his dogs.
Yeah. He's a wildlife photographer.
He's a wildlife photographer. But during the holiday season, Pete turns into you're a traveler.
The Instagram does the top nine at the end of the year where you can see your top nine posts. So I looked at my top nine posts on Instagram, and 8 dogs, 1 ice cube. It's just a dog and ice cube.
Yeah, look at that. That's funny. Yeah, all right. So coming up, we'll talk about Christmas. Is there something that Pete should know about? You've got the information, 312-981-7200. But we'll talk with Pete Zimmerman about the things you got to do this weekend when it comes to the holiday season. Stay with us.
I've got Christmas on my mind.
Even pulling out the less listened to Christmas jams, Pete Zimmerman, the great producer here on the download, is not just a behind the scenes guy who is an audiophile. No, when he hits the streets of Chicago, he becomes a Christmatologist, a man who is so obsessed with the holiday season that he thinks about it year round. That's why he's such a low profile. You don't see him doing crazy stuff in the summer because he's getting ready. This is his prime time. And we decided because Pete Christmas is so hard that we would give him his own segment each week leading up to the Christmas holiday in the month of December. We start tonight. Pete Zimmerman, the official Downloads Christmatologist.
It's here.
It's here. Where does this come from? Because last year, I think we had the same conversation, maybe the year before, to try and get at why you go all in for the Christmas season?
That's a good question. I don't really know the genesis of it. I mean, I always liked it as a kid because you got presents and you're off of school. And then that kind of led into, like, being in college. So you get presents and you're off of school. And then my first job out of college, like working in radio, like I got presents and I was off of work, you know? So there's something about, yeah, hey, this is great.
Right.
What's not to like?
It's pretty rudimentary if you really think about
it's
it.
Pretty basic.
Presents
get
and
stuff. Yeah.
You get take time off, right?
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's magical. Like we're right here on Michigan Avenue, you know, the lights and just like, you know, it's just, you know, it's cold and gray, it's dark early. And it just kind of helps me through deal with the sadness of the winter,
right?
With lights,
right? Well, I will say, all those things are true for me as well. But you go beyond. I mean, in the idea that every time I turn around, you're like, "Well, I went and saw that play, or I went to this bar, or I went to eat this place, or I went to this museum, mm-hmm. whatever you much do." So, what is it that motivates you to actually be an active, willing participant in the holiday season, not just like me, who's like, oh, I love the holidays. I'll sit at home.
Yeah, I don't really know because I'm not that active the other 11 months. I like to, you know, like go to new places, but certainly not as much. Yeah, I don't know what it is about this time that gets me out when it's cold.
All right, so let's start with, why don't we start with your home? How many Christmas trees do you have up this year?
We have 2 Christmas trees. This is the first. We have, our main real tree. Mm-hmm. And may I recommend Whole Foods?
Yeah, you went to Whole Foods route.
For a tree, because we're right by Gethsemane.
Yeah,
Gethsemane,
right. Yep.
Up there, and trees are like $300 there.
It gets really expensive there. For a long time, that was our tradition to go up there. It was almost like we felt like we were going to the country by going up
yeah,
to Andersonville.
Going out to the woods, chopping your own tree.
But I like that place a lot. I really
do.
I stand by it. I like the owner. I like everyone there. I was just always like, man, these Christmas trees are so expensive. I always long for the day of the $15 lot tree.
Yeah.
And this was long gone. I was getting the $80, $85 one. But yeah, every time I walk into the Whole Foods, I get annoyed by the Christmas trees blocking the carts. There's a ton of them everywhere.
Yeah, we're going in there to get some soy milk. Next thing you know, we're packing up a tree on the top of our car. $50.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's a good deal.
And it remains to be seen if it will last throughout the holidays.
How long is it? It only has to last till the day after Christmas. Are you the kind of guy that like lets the Christmas tree hang around till mid-January?
I've been known to have it through Super Bowl Sunday.
It's early February, right? Right.
That's usually when about the time I would get rid of the Christmas tree.
I know my wife's on a. I'm the same way. If I ever got a tree when I was single, I would keep it up till March. Like, what's the point? It's so awesome to have a new thing in your living room.
Yeah.
And my wife is. She is very. If it's not to the recycling, like thrown in the park where it says that you should recycle trees by the second week of January, it is a huge party foul.
Yeah. And, you know, normal people, this is, of course, probably similar to you, born out of laziness.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, I don't want to. What? I'm not going to get. What? It was such a hassle to put this thing up. I'm going to try to enjoy it for the full 2 months.
Do you go crazy with the ornaments? Are you a guy who's collected a bunch of ornaments? Are you?
Yeah, I have a lot of ornaments.
Traditionalist,
from
like you get them from when you were a kid.
Yeah, a lot of them for when I was a kid growing up, and then I also have a lot of, you know, bears, cubs, bulls, things that they don't make it to the. They have been kind of shuffled off now that I'm married. My wife has a lot of.
That's
good
why you have 2 trees, right?
We have a lot of really nice ornaments. And so the Coca-Cola, Chicago Bulls, Garfield, the cat, they are no longer.
They don't make it? What are you doing them? They just stay in the
box?
They
just stay in the box,
You can't even put them in a bowl?
Yeah. I wonder if I could give those to charity.
Why don't you bring them in for the swap meet or something? Or we just find a different way. Or maybe it would be fun to decorate our office with all the leftover misfit ornaments that we're no longer able to
toys.
Put up. Yeah. We should do a... Maybe we're probably too late because everyone's already done this, but we should do some sort of thing maybe for next year or even this year where we have people send in or we get everybody's in, and we find a way to honor the ornaments that did not make the cut.
Yeah. I'll bring – because we're working Wednesday. We're doing swap meet. So,
I'll bring some too.
Yeah, I'll bring all my old ornaments that didn't make the
Like the ones that, are you the kind of guy who makes your own ornaments?
No, my wife does. She makes me a special ornament every year. Her ornament was the Cubs World Series hat.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, the year before, you know, she does something special. So we have a lot of her homemade, mine are, you know, I just like buy them at stores.
My buddy, Jeremiah and, his wife, Diana, they had a ornament party one year and I totally misread the room. Like I showed up and I was like, this is gonna be fun. I'm gonna drink this eggnog and party. Who cares about the ornaments? Boy, was I wrong. They cared about the ornaments. Everybody in there had head down with like little, you know, brushes, and there was not a social, it was not a social gathering.
You were making the ornaments.
They were making
from
the
scratch.
Yeah, they're making the ornaments and getting real into it because there was some sort of competition, but everyone was like almost like silent with like goggles, like, you know, almost microscopic goggles on with the little, like, chiseled.
No,
sitting here going, are we going to hang out?
Right, yeah, I'm more into that.
Is there any dancing going on here? I did not read the room well. That was an early exit for me when my wife was like, you're an idiot. Let's go. I was like, oh, man. But it was a nice party, but I was out of my realm. So you won't do ornament parties.
No. But our house is decorated, you know, nicely. We have the two trees and it's, you know, we have a lot of Christmas, you know, ephemera around the house and things
All right.
of that nature. So
well,
it's nice.
Let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back and then we will ask Pete what we should do this weekend. What we should do both outside and inside. And then we will also talk about maybe what we should avoid. How about that? And again, if you have something that Pete should jump out and explore this weekend, 312-981-7200. He could take a look and maybe have a report back for the next Chris Metologist segment coming up next week. All right, stay with us. If you ever need it, think of my Christmas gift. If you feel that you're falling from a cliff, hold on to my Christmas gift. It's the love that I never call. It's the love. Our Chris Metologist Pete Zimmerman has your holiday recommendations for the weekend. We're going to be doing this segment each week leading up to the Christmas holiday. Pete, of course, our resident here, not just on the download, but I would say WGN, and being a specialist and an expert at what to do events both inside and out for the Christmas season. Pete, why don't we start with what do you have on this weekend's list that you think is a good thing for people to do outside? It's going to be a little warmer than it is today, mid-30s probably, but what do you like?
For a few things outside, of course, the classics are the you know, the Chris Kindle Market. There's one right here downtown by the Picasso. And then there's the new one that opened this year that's up by Wrigley Field. You know, you can shop the little markets. They have, you know, Christmas ornaments. You can get yourself a potato pancake, a sausage,
yeah, brat.
The mulled wine. Uh-huh. And then you get the traditional mug. They give you, if you get the wine,
stein, yeah.
you get
the
mug.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
the thing where every year people go nuts if it's not a boot. Their outrage happens.
How is this not a boot this year?
Yeah.
How is the Chris Kindle Market at Wrigley Field?
It's great.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And that's in the new spot, like between the hotel and the little grassy area
yep,
there?
Exactly. Yep. It's the grass area now is an ice rink. So it's a tiny little ice rink, and the ice kind of looked choppy. Mm. But, you know, most of those things are hard to maintain.
But, you know, that's, I mean, again, I always love to say that's by the Yum Yum Donuts. The Yum
right,
Yum Donuts
exactly.
is gone. But not a bad call if you are a Cubs fan or not. But the idea of making a trip to Wrigley Field when the Cubs aren't playing is actually really great.
Yeah, you're in the shadow of the field, and they have the lights on the stadium are on during this. So I mean, you're skating in the rink, and you're looking right up at Wrigley Field, or you're walking through.
Smart idea. Yeah.
And they have a nice big Christmas tree that you can take a photo next to. It's really nice. So I mean, I think it's gonna be pretty fairly decent.
My suggestion would be to do it on Sunday during the day or at night, because Saturday is going to be a bleep show up by the Wrigleyville area because of T-Box, which is on your list of things to avoid.
Right.
T-Box.
Yeah,
what is T-Box?
T-Box is the 12 bars of Xmas.
Sure it is.
And from what I gather, I've never been, but it seems like it's a pub crawl, 12 bars along Clark Street there in Wrigleyville, and you drink Coors Light, and you wear goofy sweaters and outfits. And then at night, you see people dressed up as, like, Santa Claus hammered on the CTA.
There's always Instagram accounts and blogs and things set up about to watch the 12 ugly faces of T-Box, because not unlike a Cubs game or a celebration of any form in Wrigleyville, it gets extremely out of hand because young 20-somethings overindulge.
Right.
Quickly it becomes a watching someone dressed up like Cousin Eddie from Christmas Vacation, you know, having to either relieve themselves or vomit on city property.
Yeah, it's always great to, you know, it's like you're going to miss the local journalism, like DNA Info will be reporting on the crimes that were committed.
Yeah. Right, right.
You know, the day after. So we're going to miss out on that.
Yeah, that's on Saturday. So going up to the ice rink with your family on Saturday might be a bad idea.
Yeah, go Sunday during the Bears game.
It's a perfect time to go, actually. All right, so we talk about the Chris Kindle Market at Wrigley Field. I think that's awesome. I actually might do that this weekend.
And you could... another fun thing to do is it's not really convenient to Wrigley Field, but you can make the transfers and whatnot. The holiday train runs, and if you've never been on the holiday train, you know the CTA is, you know, you get on there and it stinks and it's dirty, but for some reason the holiday train do this right.
So what is it? I mean, I've always seen the outside and I've seen pictures of it on social media, but I've never actually been in it.
It is it's a regular L train, but is completely decorated for Christmas.
Any line, or is it on the brown line?
They skip. They go through the different lines throughout the holiday season. Okay. This weekend, I believe it's going to be the blue line and the pink line. And you can go right to the website and click on when it's going to be at each station. So you can just go there, pick a stop, go there, ride a little bit, get off. So you can get on the blue line, transfer to the red line, boom, head up to Wrigley Field or whatever. But yeah, it's like it's completely decorated for Christmas. The seats are red and green. The poles are wrapped. They have elves on the train giving away mints. Great for kids. I mean, kids love it because you get to see the city all
And you can
light
go
up.
To the CTA website and tell you where to get it at what time.
Exactly. Like 5:36 at, you know, Damon and Division or whatever.
Yeah, I'm going to do that too.
Yeah.
All right. See? Nailing it here.
It's great.
So, okay. So if we have those two things as things to do and we talked about what not to do, but let's talk about inside, especially, you know, and I want to talk about what to watch on television, but I also want to talk about what to do if you're an adult and you want to have adult beverages. The bar scene here, because I've noticed in the last week or so a lot of press releases, but also announcements that there are Christmas-themed bars in Chicago.
Yeah.
I don't get it, but what is that?
It's essentially bars that are taking advantage of the holiday season and kind of redecorating themselves for the season. For example, there's a tiki bar in Logan Square called Lost Lake. Paul
it's
McGee,
a
famed mixologist in town, they transform the tiki bar into Santa's Surf Shack, and they dress up the bar in Christmas decorations. They play holiday songs all night, and they have, you know, cocktails like from 92, the Merry and Bright, and they deliver them in really fun glasses, like Santa Claus glass, Santa's butt glass. It's just really different, and a few bars do that, but I really love Lost Lake. I would recommend Lost Lake. Lost Lake opens at 4:00. And get there right when they open, because then you can get in, as opposed to
if you go Saturday at 8:00 at night,
you're going to have to wait, or you might not get in. Yeah.
But Lost Lake, which is a famed tiki bar in Logan Square, dressing up as Santa's Surf Shack.
Right. And then you have your classics like Butch McGuire's down on Division, which, you know, they get a zillion lights, a train going around the bar. Simon's up near me in Andersonville. They decorate really nicely. They serve the glug, and they give you a little cookie. Those are probably the, top I would say, places. Simons, Butch McGuire's, Cork and Carry, a classic where I grew up on the South Side, also a terrific bar that transforms the bar into a Christmas heaven.
All right. I'm loving this. I feel like I'm going to go home, and I'm going to talk to my wife, and I'm going to say, hey, let's do this. She's going to say no, but I feel like I'm contributing. Like, she'll probably be surprised because she'll be like, wow, you really want to do this stuff?
You're about. I mean, you have the big snowman in front of the house.
She's into it. But I'm just saying, like, she doesn't expect me to be into it. And my suggestion is, like, if I go in there being like, let's hit the bar. We got to go to Simon's. Then we've got to go to Cork and Carry. She's going to be like, what are you talking about? I'm going to day drink. All the way. And I'm like, why not, Miles? You can just wait in the car. It's okay.
Yeah. That might be a little difficult.
It might be difficult. All right. We'll continue this. We'll take a break. We'll get an update on Rob's news. And then we come back. Let's talk about what we can watch on television this weekend, including a Hallmark special that Pete and Molly just began with their podcast about watching the Hallmark movies on for Christmas. So that's coming up here on The Download, so stay with us.
Oh, when you find for some sad reason you're alone this Christmas season, and the joys of home grow dimmer, just like a memory's distant glimmer. When you're loving, you are parted, and all Christmas cheer departed. It's sad, I say.
There it is, some more off the beaten path Christmas music provided by DJ Zim. Pete Zimmerman, our Christmatologist, who beats by Zim. He, of course, is the man who is bringing us Christmas cheer this holiday season. Each week he gives us what to do this weekend. We now know that we need to go see the Kris Kringle Market, Kindle Market up at Wrigley Field. We have to find a way to make a transfer so we can get on the holiday train, which will be on the Blue Line this weekend. And that we also will be going to Simon's, Butch McGuire's, Cork and Carry, and, of course, Lost Lake, all in one night, and while avoiding T-Box. That's what we've learned so far from tonight.
There's one more outside thing I want to quickly mention, because we have such a good relationship with the city. They do a great thing at the Bean there on Friday nights at 6 o'clock from 6 to 7. They have choirs and groups, and they set up right in front of the Bean and sing Christmas carols.
Oh, it's so great.
So if you're
it's
out
so
there,
great.
Enjoy, like tomorrow, like they had like the Leo High School choir out there last week.
So
and,
fun.
So if you're downtown, I would definitely, go around there
from
at
6 to 7
tomorrow.
Wow. That's a great idea. Might have to partake in that as well. I love this. Uh-huh. This is great. That's wonderful. All right, so what should we watch on television? You guys just started the podcast,
mm-hmm.
Which is getting rave reviews, critical acclaim. Tell us what the podcast is, and then we could talk about what people should watch the Hallmark film and then listen to the at the same time, turn the sound down, and listen to what you guys are doing.
The podcast is called Molly and Pete Save Christmas. Molly is my wife. And we are fans of the Hallmark Christmas movies, and they run on two stations. They run on the Hallmark station and the Hallmark Movies and Mystery station. And there's new ones every year. There's like 20 new ones. They start in November, and they run a new one like each Saturday. And we're fans of these movies. Often they're horrible, but they're really fun to watch. So we watch one of these episodes and then we talk about it on the podcast.
As my son told me, we were watching something, I forgot what it was, in fifth grade, 10 years old. He goes, oh gosh, we are so hate watching this. So he said, I was like, what? It's like, wow.
Yeah. Because they're all somewhat similar in that There's a city boyfriend who, you know, just wants to make the money. And then there's a country boyfriend who, you know, hey, man, I'm all about Christmas. And then a woman who, you know, she's like, has a great, you know, job as a high-powered attorney, but really thinks that her calling is ice sculpting. I'm going to give up the high-powered attorney job. And, you know, I'm going to just, I'm going to be an ice sculptor. So they're funny, so and they're enjoyable.
Is the podcast, forgive me for not hearing it yet, but is the podcast almost like a DVD commentary? Or are you reviewing it, the two of you?
We're just kind of talking you through the episode.
Got it.
So you don't necessarily need to see the episode, but if you're familiar, you know, it helps if you're familiar with what the style of a Hallmark movie is.
Okay, so the one that you did is, what's the name of it?
It's called it was called A Song to Remember. And it is it's a good one. It's similar to the TV show Nashville, and there's like a country star whose bus breaks down in a Christmas town.
Reba McEntire?
No. Their tour bus breaks down in a Christmas town, and nobody knows who she is except one of the guys in the Christmas town. He's an aspiring country artist who's afraid to leave the Christmas town and take his talents to Nashville. And it's their burgeoning romance. It's a good one, Song to Remember.
We'll talk about that one.
And you know, you can just turn on 321, whatever it is, on your cable box, and there'll be a good one.
Just oftentimes
featuring a Candace Cameron Bure, a Winnie Cooper.
Oh yeah,
she's in a lot of them.
Right.
My favorites are the Alicia Witt episodes.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
It's good stuff.
All right. Okay. All right. I feel like we've got it.
Just dive in.
So you, at this point, the download listener, you have options to go outside.
Mm-hmm.
You have options to drink inside.
Mm-hmm.
You have options to watch stuff on TV and not leave the house.
Yeah. I think you're set up.
And if you don't want to watch TV, you can stay at home and go through your old ornaments and see which ones might work to put in a bowl to send to us at the download.
I cannot wait.
Right?
Yeah.
I think we nailed it.
I want to see old ornaments.
So, okay, so this is this considered where we're at right now, December 7? Are we in the throes of it? I mean, is this prime time?
Yeah, we're getting into it now, because a lot of times, you know, officially we like to think the Thanksgiving after Thanksgiving is kind of the start of the season. But like Simon's might not have their decorations up that Saturday.
Right.
So you kind of give them a couple of weeks to get their decorations up. Butch McGuire's, I think, starts early like November. There's a place that we visited New York for the holiday last year, a place called Rolf's. I read about it. It's like, oh, Christmas decorations, blah, blah, blah. I'm like, oh, this is great. It's going to be like Butch McGuire's. You go in there, it's beautiful. Christmas decorations all over. Then I was reading the menu, and it said on the bottom, it's like, Christmas decorations stay up through May.
Like, what? That's not acceptable.
Like, no.
Lazy. That's going too lazy.
That is unacceptable. That is,
if you get to Cinco de Mayo, you've gone too long with the Christmas decorations. No doubt about it. Well, celebrate the most wonderful time of the year with WGN Radio. Tune in to the WGN Radio Holiday Spectacular on Friday, December 15th from 10 a.m. to noon. Because Pete's not the only one who Christmas so hard. Stephanie Menendez here is a prime contender. We should have her come on, give her recommendations. Because, again, I follow her and talk to her, and it's just nonstop.
I can't believe how much she does.
Yeah,
I mean,
awesome.
I'll limit my thing, my happenings to the weekends, Saturday night, Sunday night, but Stephanie's doing it every night.
I feel like I'm having a better Christmas season because of Stephanie's social media.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, oh, yay.
Yeah, you're living vicariously.
Yeah, right. This is what we're doing with our Holiday Spectacular. We're doing a live review reminiscent of the popular variety shows of the past. It's featuring co-host Bill Leff and Domati Pongo, plus all of your favorite WGN radio hosts, us included. We're going to do a bit. I'm looking forward to it. You'll hear seasonal songs, stories, Yuletide poetry, sketches, and more performed live right here in the Allstate Showcase studio. The party also stars retro rock and roll band Rosie and the Rivets, plus cameo performances by Tom Skilling and Bill Curtis. Wow, that's awesome. And you want to check out rehearsal videos from the cast as well. You can find it at the events page on WGNradio.com. Sponsored by American Sale for the Christmas tree lights and holiday decor you've been looking for. Search AmericanSale.com. Hannah Stanley's in for Patty Vasquez coming up here at 11 o'clock. I got to say, I had a tough week this week. I had, I just had like health issues with, I had a colonoscopy last Friday, which is fine. It was routine. Everything's good.
It wasn't an emergency colonoscopy.
It wasn't an emergency. And the doctor came out afterwards and said, beautiful colon. That's a direct quote. So everything worked out okay. That was routine. That was fine. But I don't know. Just like coming out. It's the first time I've been under, and I just got sick from it. So whatever. I'm okay. But earlier this, I want to tell the story because I couldn't believe it. So yesterday I was driving around when the Hawks games were off. So I went to the gas station, got gas. You know, things you do when there's a Blackhawks game on. Pumped the gas, came out, started the car up. Dead. Car wouldn't turn over.
Cold.
It sounded like an alternator. So I had to get a tow truck, do the whole thing, you know. But
someone who doesn't know anything about cars, I remember being young and having this happen and always saying, I think it's the alternator.
Yeah.
I think it's
that's
the alternator.
That's the go-to. You're so embarrassed. Yeah. The tow truck guy showed up, and I had worked to get it to a mechanic, and everything was all set up. And then the tow truck driver's like, it's the battery.
Oh.
And I'm like, it can't be. I like already came up with some things. I'm like, the light on the dome is on, you know, the dashboard's working. Yeah. It's not that. He takes out the thing and he jumps it and it works.
Yeah.
But then he also says your battery is terrible. You know, we were just having this conversation on Wednesday about, we were talking about driverless technology and whether or not I'm ready to move to a more subscription like thing that everyone's talking about. I'm almost there because my car is pretty old now, 2006. And he said the battery's toast. It's like, this is an old battery. You need a new battery. It's not going to work this winter. It's like, don't drive around and shut it off because it's not going to come back on. That's what he told me. He's like, it's out of juice. He's like, so you need to go to
and now need to replace this now.
So this is all last night. And I'm like, I wasn't feeling good, and I was like, ugh. So I went to the AutoZone, which is on North Avenue, North and Western. And I called him. I'm like, do you guys do a battery swap? Because that's what the guy goes. He goes, find an AutoZone because a lot of times they'll do the battery right there for you. And they were like, yeah, they kind of hedged and hawed. They're like, yeah, maybe if it's too hard, we won't.
Hard?
Yeah, because I guess there's different ways that batteries are in different cars, like with a lot of strap-ins and stuff. So I'm like, oh, this is going to take all night, man.
Oh,
it's
just
cold out.
It's cold.
You know what I mean?
You hate going into auto shops.
At late, not like 8:30 at night or 8 o'clock. I went into the AutoZone just west of, between Humble Park and Wicker Park there on 2400 West, whatever, North Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And I talked to a guy named Roberto, and I have not had a better experience in my entire life. And I don't say this for any other reason than the dude helped me out. Didn't know who I was, nothing like that, but I walked in there.
So this is not his job.
I guess it is his job,
mm-hmm.
but I mean, I'm not saying because I get money from AutoZone. I didn't get a deal.
Yeah.
I'm like, you know, it was a great store. You know what you guys should check out? No, I don't. Nothing like that.
Yeah.
I went in as an anonymous stranger going up to the door. And then he came out to the parking lot. And he's like, yeah, I'll do it. Then he went back in, rang it up, put the gloves on, went out to the car, flipped the battery, put the new one in. It's like, turned it on. It was working. He's like, see you later. It took 12 minutes.
Did you give him a little extra on the side?
I did.
Yeah.
I didn't want to bring that part up because it was not about me, Pete.
Oh.
You know?
You toss a buck his way for the effort.
So I gave him a little bit. But it was an experience that I wanted to call out because he deserved it. Like, for a lot of times that you deal with where you go sit at a chair in an auto mechanic's place or they say, you know, it's going to take 3 days.
Yeah.
Or the Willie, the tow truck driver, and Roberto at AutoZone, they made an experience that could have been tons of money and days on end of trying. Because you know I would have got it into the dealership's mechanic, and they were like, I think your problem is not the battery. I think the problem is the alternator. Like, they would have.
We kind of talk about this a lot, where in this age of customer service, do you think this is above and beyond what
Yes.
Okay.
I think so. I think that the guy, even if it wasn't above and beyond, the experience could have easily gone awry.
Yeah.
It easily could have been like, I don't feel like it, or this doesn't really work for me, or I'm going to take my time.
Mm-hmm.
You know what? So there are customers in the store.
Yeah.
It wasn't just
yeah.
me. So I feel like for him to do that and do it in kind of a succinct way and to have the experience be timed under 15 minutes.
Yeah. That's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. Like I was
ready to get home at 11.
I thought this was just the beginning of a kind of a slow nightmare.
Yeah.
And it was over and it works and the car works today and it's all good. It's just a new battery. I was impressed. So Roberto, hats off. Good job. Okay, my last story. You ready for this, Hannah? Hannah Stanley in studio.
I am ready. You talk as much as you want because I don't know that I'm capable of it.
All right. So we'll get to that in just a second as we get you ready for this. But I worked at the school book fair this morning.
For your son?
Yeah.
Cool.
So is it the school, you know?
Scholastic.
Yeah, right. Exactly. And so I'm just an assistant. I'm a person who helps. I walk around with the kids and they all have money. They all have some kids don't, some do. And if they have money, then it's budgeted. So they have to figure out math, and I'm the person who goes, well, have you tried a subtraction? And they don't answer. I go, it's 14, man. Come on. So I loved it. It was great, and it was fun to watch the kids, especially as they get older, fifth grade, sixth grade. They know what they're doing. Kindergarten's a mess because you're like, many? And you're like, oh, this is not. No, you can't have that pencil and that pencil. Don't cry.
Yeah, the bookmarks are free.
Yeah, right. So what happened was this one kid comes up to me. And he's like, I go, is everything okay? I initiated. I go, is everything okay? And he's like, he had two books. And they were educational books. They were good books.
Oh, that
They
hurts.
Weren't like the unauthorized Taylor Swift picture book. You know, that kind of stuff where you're like, okay, don't buy that.
That's just
or the Lego store. Yeah, all that kind of stuff that you're like, all right, you're just, this was like, these were solid choices. Mm-hmm. And there were just two of them. And the kid was like a dollar short. And I know the school policy is probably like, hey, they got to learn how to budget, whatever. And the kid is, you know.
And you were like, here's the dollar.
I gave him the dollar.
Good for you.
Yeah. And I said, I essentially, which I realize now, it's kind of weird. I'm like, don't tell anybody. You know, it's kind of a weird thing to say. But I also said to him, I said, hey, at some point, I was referring back to what happened to me last night. I was like, hey, at some point in your life, I'll be stranded on the side of the road with a flat tire. You'll help me out. Kids was deer in a headlight, like, what are you talking about?
And he was like, you just gave me money. This has got so many warning signs. You're talking
so about here's the, side of the here's road. The Larry David moment. The moment that I turned from good guy to bad guy is I watch him. I've got a warm heart. And I watch the kid go up to the cash register. And the cash register gives him back about 70 cents. He pockets it.
That's awesome.
He pockets it. There's a bucket right there for donations for Houston. You know, for flood victims. Nah, he pockets it, puts in his sweats, walks away. I'm like, hey.
Hey, maybe he saved it and bought another kid's milk today.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe paid it forward. Know. Like today, he took that 70
like he probably,
cents.
He probably stayed up late last night worried about the fact that he
was
like,
a dollar
didn't
short.
Handle that correctly.
Yeah.
Like,
well,
oh, man, I should have given that.
Well, that's it was right out of, I mean, if I would have gone and confronted the kid
really
in the hallway, it would have been a Larry David Kirby enthusiasm.
That is
I just,
that's a movie
you
set.
Know, I saw you and then just stare at him for a little bit. Pretty.